I call the Agriculture Committee meeting to order. It is March 16th, 2023. Can I have a motion from someone to approve? Oh, I'm sorry, there is a quorum present. May I have a motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Tabke moves the minutes from, this was 2 days ago, March 14th, 2023. Any discussion? All approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. The motion passes. The minutes are adopted from last meeting.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point here that I think a lot of us received an email late last night from Laura Lemke, the feed grain people, and she wasn't given a chance to testify at the hearing on the grain indemnity fund, and I think her testimony would have been very key, very important. So will there be an opportunity again for her to present her facts and opinions as she would see fit?
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I know there was a letter from her group in our packet, and I can confer at the last meeting I saw that, and I can confer with staff and the chair about if and when that's possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, our first agenda item is our MDA Farm Link presentation. The presenters can approach the stand. Oh, it's online. Okay, great. So direct your attention to the screens. And our presenter online, please go ahead, state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jim Ostley. I'm a livestock development and planning specialist as well as the FarmLink coordinator with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's Ag Marketing and Development Division.
Thank you, sir. Would you be able to speak a little bit louder or closer to the microphone so we can hear you more clearly in the committee room? Thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm going to go ahead and, well, first off, can you hear me all right?
Yep, that's great. Thank you.
Wonderful. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And this is information that I believe you have in your packets.
We did have your screen up for a moment, but then it went away.
Okay.
Okay, we think if you keep talking, then it might work out okay.
All right, I'm going to try this again. All right.
Excellent. Thank you. Please proceed. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to first thank you for the opportunity to present on FarmLink today. I had all of intentions in being there in person. However, Mother Nature had something else in store for us today, just like she has for the last couple of months. The primary focus of Minnesota FarmLink is to get the next generation of farmers on the land. With the average age of the Minnesota farmer being 55 years old and roughly 70% of farmland projected to transfer ownership in the next 20 years, farmland access and succession is a significant priority. FarmLink began as a simple spreadsheet developed in 2007 with a very simple listing service web application being created in 2009. The original focus was providing a common location for landowners, realtors, and auction companies for a way to advertise land and farms for sale or rent. With increased interest from Minnesota farmers and beginning and emerging farmers seeking opportunities to connect with each other and move forward together in a farm business, 2011 saw the program expanded to list beginning farmers and existing farm owners who were both seeking to transition either into a farm or out of a farm. The prior FarmLink web application was quite obsolete, and the program required staff time to collect participation forms, enter much of the data into the system for the public to view, connect people through phone calls and email while ensuring privacy, and then documenting all of that correspondence. Because of you all, Minnesota FarmLink was given funding to improve the web application, and this process of updating had been years in the making and was finally completed in very late of 2022. Today, the primary objective of FarmLink is to get that next generation of farmers on the land. However, the FarmLink tool has been expanded. It continues to be a resource for people seeking out land or farms to purchase or rent, for those wanting to list agricultural properties for sale or rent, a connection tool for those wanting to farm with those that are already farming, and now includes the opportunities for farms and ag businesses to list employment opportunities and opportunities for those interested in working on a farm or an ag business to post resume type listings. This is a screenshot of the FarmLink homepage. The public can visit without the need to log in and see lists within each category. Listings are for sale or for rent or provide contact information to the public. However, those seeking or providing transition, employment, or mentorships can only see limited information with no private or contact information available for the public viewing. Some of the benefits of the newly upgraded FarmLink web platform include being self-serviceable. It's account-based. There's no passwords to remember. Each time you log in, you'll be emailed and texted an access code. There's no fees associated with using FarmLink. It's open to farmers, ag businesses, realtors, and landowners. Provides general application forms for each type of listing with opportunities to explain in narrative. There's no waiting to exchange information. There's no cold calling. The use of blind emails is used through our web application to share general information before making a commitment to a connection and providing contact information. The web application itself sends out reminders when listings will expire and asks the listing agent or individual to log back in to reactivate. And it gives more focus, allows more focus by the FarmLink coordinator, which is myself, to work with users on access and transition resources instead of having to manually input all the data and exchange information and document correspondence between different parties. In addition to funding for FarmLink, the FarmLink web application improvements, dollars were given to begin the creation of farmland access and succession teams. The goal was to mimic the success of the Minnesota Dairy Initiative team approach in working through farm issues, but specific to farmland access and succession. $25,000 was contracted to both Minnesota Farm Bureau and the Minnesota Dairy Initiative to develop these specific teams as needed. So much of what is being done in farmland access and succession is short term, and the reality is landowners need long-term assistance and follow-up to actually follow through with a transition plan. Contracts for these will end in June, with final reporting due by July 15th. However, we're already receiving feedback. Most importantly, we've been told there is an overwhelming need for assistance, and financial resources currently provided are not enough to secure the professionals needed to coordinate teams long-term. It has been found that the team approach does work, but it needs to be long-term in its funding and have a dedicated individual or individuals to coordinate it. The good news out of this feedback is that we're attempting to meet a very important need to the next generation of farmers on the land in continuing that farming legacy. With that, I thank you for the opportunity to present to this committee, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ausley. Committee members, we have a very full agenda today, but if there's a brief question for the presenter, we can entertain that before moving on. Great, seeing none. Thank you very much for your presentation, sir. And we will have our first bill before us. So Representative Wolgamott, please approach. So welcome back to the committee. Since Representative Wolgamott is not on the committee, I will move House File 2110. before the committee to be laid over for possible inclusion in an agriculture omnibus bill. Once you are ready, Representative Wolgamott, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Wolgamott, and I am very excited to be here before you this afternoon to present House File 2110, which is a bill to appropriate $200,000 per year to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture for grants to the Center for Rural Policy and Development. A little background on the Center for Rural Policy and Development for you, Madam Chair and members. The legislature actually created the CRPD in statute in 1997 to produce unbiased research for policymakers. How it works is policy leaders set the research agenda, and a majority of their board is appointed by the governor, and there are two members of the majority party legislators, one in the House and one in the Senate. What this bill does is it reinstates the funding for the CRPD into the base. It had always been that way until just recent years. So we're getting the appropriation back in the base, and we're actually giving an increase of $100,000 to the original appropriation to account for inflation and the ability to retain staff, produce more research. And, Madam Chair and members, this would actually be the first time ever that CRPD has received a funding increase since 1997. And one last thing, Madam Chair, before I turn it over to my testifier here, I'd like to thank Representative Anderson for his support for the bill and for his being a champion for this legislation in the past. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifier, and then we'll be more than happy to take any questions that you or members of your committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Please testify or identify yourself for the record and begin.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Julie Tesh, and I'm president and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. There is a brief presentation maybe up there, but we'll just get right into it. Like Representative Wolgamott said, our organization was created by the legislature in 1997 with the mission of providing policy leaders like yourself with critical, unbiased research through a rural lens. Now, you may be wondering, why exactly do we need research specifically on rural Minnesota? And the reason is because it's difficult to find research. It's notoriously hard to find research specifically on rural America and specifically rural Minnesota. Our research and rural economic analysis efforts are rooted in the belief that for small towns and communities to thrive, rural leaders need access to data and information that can influence their efforts and economic strategies. A majority of the topics that we research affect the entire state of Minnesota. We provide the information from a rural lens, which is often otherwise a perspective often left out of the conversation. As you all know, America, and especially rural America, has undergone seismic change in the last 20 years, and we are committed to using data to ensure there is available research that reflects this evolution and the opportunities that accompany it. Even in this last year, we have seen trends and data change across Minnesota. From 2020 to 2021, the population of rural Minnesota actually increased for the first time in decades. So those are the type of trends that we follow. We recognize the critical importance of making data and research both available and accessible to community leaders, grant writers, economic development coordinators, and such. We also understand that it can be difficult to find research that is completely unbiased and nonpartisan. So we are proud to be a trusted and tested organization providing that information. I can't quite tell if I'm just going to go, we'll wing it here, going off of what Representative Wolgamott said. Like he said, we have a 20-member board. We were created in 1997. We're funded partially by the state and also partially by foundations. And so we're our own 501c3. And I just want to quickly, it's myself and I have two staff members who are rock star staff members. They do all of our research. They do it very, very well. Is it up there?
Looks like we've got a blank screen up there.
That's okay. I know one of the questions I typically get is, how do you determine what your topics are? And fortunately, I can tell you that all of you will be receiving in your email or paper copies of our thought leader survey that will be coming out in the coming weeks. And what we do is we list 15 to 20 topics that we see going on in rural Minnesota. And we ask you and other decision makers, whether that's county commissioners, city council members, administrators, I love technology. Okay, we're going without it. But what we do is we take all that information, we ask people like yourself who make decisions, what exactly is going on in your community, rural or urban, but specifically rural, what are you seeing and what's happening? From there, we compile that information, put it together, and we come up with a thought leader survey that our research committee goes through, and we typically select between 4 and 7 topics per year. This year, topics that we have been looking at are, we did childcare, and we were actually the canary in the coal mine about 7 years ago talking about the lack of childcare and how it's an economic development issue. And so specifically in rural Minnesota, our report was on best practices. We also do a lot of work on workforce shortages. Our most recent report was on the rural mental health workforce and the shortage of actual workforce staff. The next report coming out will be on rural education funding and the formulas, and just trying to help people understand where that comes from and how the formulas work. And then rounding out this next year, we'll be doing something on rural housing, and then also on the decline of rural newspapers and civic engagement. So we're very excited about that. So we have topics that range all across the board, but we rely on you all to fill out that survey to let us know. And I believe you have a handout in front of you that might show, handout right there that shows our other topics. Let's see, very quickly, if you want to follow us on social media, please do. RuralMN.org is our website. I have an intern right now through the Citizens League through Capital Pathways, and he's getting us up to speed on Instagram, so you can be looking for Instagram really shortly too. But we're on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube. One of the things that I have failed to mention is that we were created to do white paper research. And while we still do that, we put it into more easier ways to digest that research. So we have a podcast, we do videos, we do webinars, blog posts, the whole nine yards. We have our own YouTube channel. So for you that are all very busy, you can go to our website and determine how you want to see this research and go from there. If you want to read the full report, you are welcome to it. But just know that there's little bits and pieces there. And with that, I'll yield to any questions.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Are there any other testifiers from the public who wish to speak on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to compliment you on the research you do. Your topics are timely, from child care in rural areas to rural medicine, that type of thing. My only positive suggestion would be, and you touched on it now, is kind of raising awareness of what you do. Sometimes, I think, in the deluge of emails we get, some things kind of get buried. So the different ways you can reach us and let us know things are out there, the better. But again, you do excellent research, and it's done impartially. So I want to thank you for that, and keep up the good work.
If you care to, do you have a response?
Chair Purcell, Chair Anderson, thank you very much. And yes, that is actually our number one issue, is trying to get people to read the research. And so, if you have suggestions, please let me know. If there's other forms of media, I don't think we'll go on TikTok, but if you have other ideas, please let us know what we can do to get the research into your hands better.
Thank you, Ms. Tesh. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you, Representative Wolgamont, for carrying this legislation. And the work that the Center for Rural Policy and Development does impacts some of the work that I'm working on as well. I'm trying to help get the Center for Rural Behavioral Health started in Mankato. And I know that the work that they do and the advocacy that they do as well is impacted by the work that you do. And so I just wanted to point that out. And how there's intersections all over the place that impact all of us, especially the work in the mental health fields. And I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Thank you. Any other member discussion, comments, questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to lay over House File 2110 for potential inclusion in our agriculture omnibus bill. I don't need to take a vote, right? Okay, the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Volgamont.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
The next bill we will be hearing is House File 860. Representative Petersburg, when you get yourself up there. Representative Petersburg, welcome to the Ag Committee. And since Representative Petersburg is not on the committee, I will move House File 860 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Agriculture Omnibus Bill. Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. This is not a new bill to this committee. Over the years, you've heard it a few times. Every few years, we ask for this, and I believe it's in the governor's budget, but it's a program that I think is exemplified something that is an example for the rest of the regions of the state to use as well. And so we bringing it to you as a way for just expansion and being aware of it. This particular program that we're asking for $25,000 a year is for a really kind of a farm-to-market type trade show. And I'm going to let the person beside me talk to you about this and then answer any other questions. This is former Congressman and President of Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, Tim Penny. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll leave it to you.
Thank you so much, Congressman Penny.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. It's good to be here before your committee. This room is not unfamiliar to me. I hate to say it, but 40 years ago when I was a state senator, I was the vice chairman of the Finance Committee, and this was our main meeting room at that time. Good to see several people from our corner of the state on this committee, and thanks for the opportunity to testify. I'm Tim Penny, president of the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation. And we are located in Owatonna, Minnesota, but we serve a 20-county region in south-central southeastern Minnesota. We are one of six rural foundations that cover collectively the 80 non-metro counties in the state. And we were established 37 years ago to invest in the economic future of our respective rural regions. Our foundation does basically three things. We have a series of programs dedicated strictly to the smaller towns in our region. We invest about $2 million annually in early childhood provider trainings and also some of those dollars to address the early childhood shortage in our region. And then we invest in entrepreneurial activity in our region, totaling a couple million dollars every year. I'll hand this. Is there some?
I believe the page is passing around handouts for it, too.
And that's our annual report. You can just pass it up the table for folks to look at just to give you a better idea of our work. But as part of our entrepreneur work, we've helped create a collaborative in southern Minnesota around local foods. We feel it's an important sector of our local economy. More and more restaurants, grocery stores are trying to source locally. We want to take folks who want to go beyond the farmers markets to build a successful business around local foods and help them navigate that future. So with the funding that we receive from the state of Minnesota, $25,000 annually, we are in the base budget at the Department of Agriculture. We match that at our foundation. And then we have other resources that are brought to bear to support this local foods work. It results in basically two major activities every year. One is an annual marketplace, which is like a farmer's market on steroids. It's been held at the Rochester Civic Center for 8 years now. This past year, and I think this is one of the handouts that Representative Petersburg made available to the committee, we had 90 exhibitors at this event, 1,300 visitors. To this event, and it helps to elevate awareness, understanding, education about local foods, the value of local foods, the importance of that sector to our economy. But it also results in sales at the event. And on average, I think several hundred dollars of proceeds go home with our exhibitors at the event. The second event is held in March. This will be in Cannon Falls. And it's we call it a trade show where we have exhibitors set up and present their products, and then buyers are there to sample these products, and it results in many contracts between the sellers and the buyers to advance their local food business success. There is a handout for that as well that's been made available by Representative Petersburg's office, but I will give an update because we have that event coming up in just a couple weeks' time on March 23rd. This year we have 57 food businesses signed up for that event, and we have 63 buyers planning to attend that event. And again, if this holds true to last year's outcomes, you will find that the outcome was that 55% of the buyers made purchase contracts that very day. The other 45% were in negotiation for potential food purchases. So with an even larger number of exhibitors and buyers this year, we think the event is going to be even better in terms of advancing and supporting the future of local foods across rural. We do have exhibitors from all across the state, even though this is held in southern Minnesota. And I will simply close by saying that one of our exhibitors came all the way from the Halleck area and confided in me as the trade show was being held back in November, that of all the shows that she and her business exhibited at, ours was the best in terms of the opportunity it gave them to get the word out about their product and to seek additional buyers. And so I thought that was high praise for somebody that came that many miles and felt it was worth the trip. So if there are further questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but it is in the base budget, and the partnership with the Minnesota Department of Ag has been outstanding. They are part of the planning committee every year, and they always have a booth at each of these events so that they can also advertise the programs and services that are available for through the Minnesota Department of Ag.
Thank you very much. Are there any other testifiers? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I was just going to comment that, you know, this is an opportunity for small entrepreneur, small farmers and agricultural product providers, an opportunity to get out and actually meet with potential clients and really expand. And without this, it's very difficult for some of them to really maneuver through that. And so it's a great program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I've also handed out the annual Feast magazine, which is designed, again, to promote public understanding of the importance of local foods to Minnesota's economy and also to help promote these events that I've just described.
Right. Are there any other testifiers before we move to member discussion? Anyone wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Petersburg, thanks. You've carried this bill a number of years, and it's a good event, a good thing you're carrying. I do have to say that I think of all the recurring spending bills we've seen this year, I think yours is the first that hasn't asked for an increase in funding. So congratulations on that. It's a judicious use of money, and thank you.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you for that, and I have to admit that the gentleman next to me has been able to keep it under control, and he has done a great job. And it actually, because of its self-promotion, it also has benefited from additional sales through that as well. But thank you, Mr. Penny.
Representative Chop.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. Thank you, Petersburg, and former congressman. In my past life, I was a digital creator, you know, Adobe expert in publishing. And I will say this, that print is not dead, okay? Print is not dead. Because in communities like yours and like mine, we still value AM radio and print, right? We haven't really gone to digital because there's a lot of fake news on digital media. But when it comes to print, it's very important. So the project that you're working on here, I like it, you know, because it creates a channel for communication within communities, within that community, and also advocates for those producers and buyers, right? And so I think that anything that we can do as a legislator in this committee to promote more farmers and more organic growth within these farming communities is a positive. So thank you so much for continuing work, and good luck.
Neither comments or discussion. I will take the chair's privilege to say thank you for serving my community and the many communities in the Cannon River watershed that I've served for the last 8 years. Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation does a lot with the resources that you have. So thank you, Representative Petersburg, for bringing this. And I believe with that, we can renew the motion to potentially lay over this bill 860 for our agriculture omnibus. The bill is laid over. Thank you. Next up, Representative Tabke, House File 2288. I'm going to take a moment to make sure the technology is properly connected.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I can get started while that's getting figured out.
Please go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, I have House File 2288 that I recommend being laid over for possible inclusion of future omnibus bill.
So you are moving the bill before the committee?
Yes.
Excellent. Go ahead, Representative Happy, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. Before I get started on the bill, I want to recognize a student from U of M who is here hanging out with me today, Kyle Thompson. I'm going to wave over here. U of M and agriculture program, and watching the ag bill, and also hanging out with me today. So thanks for being here, Kyle. So this is a bill for funding. A little more space. Thank you. For funding and staffing of winter greenhouses. And so we started working on this my first term in the legislature, so in 2019, with the Extension Center for Sustainable Research. And so since then, there's been a series of iterations of deep winter greenhouses. And so the goal of this is across the state of Minnesota to be able to grow produce all winter long and all year long. So this has the ability to keep temperature. So what it does is it takes solar energy and it stores it in the ground within a greenhouse. And then all night long, it takes and releases that that heat so that it keeps a temperature between 40 and 50 degrees and allows us to have all year long access to cold seasoned vegetables for greens and that kind of thing. And so this really came back up again because we have a massive supply chain issue throughout the United States, but most importantly to me here in Minnesota, where we get our lettuce and cold seasoned vegetables from California and from the southern half of the United States, another place where there's a significant amount of transportation that's involved and those kinds of things. And so this will allow us, my goal with this is to eventually build thousands of these across the state of Minnesota so that we have local food production all across the state. So this has been really well used in the North Shore. So a lot of the resorts and different restaurants on the North Shore have been using this type of production in order to make sure that we have food all year round. And so we have Greg Schweizer here as my testifier to talk a little bit more. And so there is a packet. I don't know if it was handed out or, oh, yep, it's been handed out. So just some information about it and then a PowerPoint, Madam Chair. So if we go to my testifier, that'd be great.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Go ahead, please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, I'm Greg Schweizer. I'm the Statewide Sustainable Ag and Food Systems Director for the University of Minnesota Extension's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. I've been working with Deep Winter Greenhouses on this program for a number of years now, and I will go through and show you how they work and give you a little info. So as Brad mentioned, the Deep Winter Greenhouse, if you can see over the left, it takes solar heat from a steeply sloped south-facing glazing wall, and that heat rises to the peak of the greenhouse where it's drawn underground through some ductwork into a thermal mass, in this case of crushed rock and an insulated foundation. That heat seeps out of the greenhouse at night, creating a growing environment where crops can grow and thrive without relying on an extraordinary amount of fossil fuel heat. So one of the things that these greenhouses thrive on, a crop product that works really well, are our salad greens and brassicas, things like lettuces, mustards, arugula, chard, kale, those kinds of things. They love those cold nights and those hot days. They grow great. We We've got some other people experimenting with exotic crops like turmeric and ginger on the top and passion fruit, cherimoya, and other things. Just a taste of where the citizen scientists will take this in the future. So now we've developed the farm-scale winter greenhouse. The smaller greenhouses worked great, but they were too expensive, so we went back to the drawing board and developed a larger-scale greenhouse that we're, after our two prototypes in the city of Minneapolis have been created, we know that they work and they work well, and we're excited at this point that we're able to get them out and ready to be used on the landscape. So some of the people, some of the types of farmers that will use these, we have small diversified farms throughout Minnesota who grow a number of products. With the addition of a winter crop, this makes these small farmers much more viable and much more potentially to have much more success with their operations. So the one here is Alternative Roots Farm in Medelia, Minnesota. They've been a partner with our Deep Winter Greenhouse work for a number of years. And as you can see, they grow apples, hogs, raspberries, and now winter crops as well. Another great candidate for this work are emerging farmers. We've had a number of workshops with the Hmong American Farmers Association. Hmong farmers, as many of us know, are some of the best specialty crop producers in Minnesota, and they've got an interest in this technology as well. And finally, to wrap this up, in order to expand this work, we want to replicate and expand the previous Deep Winter Greenhouse Initiative work we have done with our smaller scale greenhouse, where we would like to build a greenhouse, six greenhouses throughout greater Minnesota, so that everybody who's interested has the chance to go meet with a farmer that's operating one of these greenhouses, kick the tires, see how it works, and have the ability to have extension outreach education going on. We also need some staffing to make this happen, and we would like to have a research greenhouse on campus so we can continue to develop the efficiency of this technology and expand some of the production technology as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Swisser. Representative Hapke, did you have anything more to add for your initial presentation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the only thing to add is that we're going to ask for we're asking for $1.48 million in order to be included in the omnibus bill in order to build the six greenhouses, to staff them, and then also to have labor and organizing on the organic farm. So thank you.
excuse me. Are there any folks in the audience who care to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we have member discussion. I'm going to start by asking if these locations already exist and are chosen, these six locations around greater Minnesota?
They are not. We would have a competitive process.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Chalk.
Thank you. What's the price per square feet to build one of these?
I'd have to do the quick calculation. The new farm scale greenhouse came in at about $26,000 total. So that's at about 900 square feet of operable space, but let's see, 60 times 22 is about 1,200 of indoor space.
Representative Chaw.
Thank you, Chip Arcel. I like this because in Northern California, where I lived, we did this with tropical fruits such as mangoes and papaya. And so what we did, because there were like colder winters in Northern California, we built this greenhouse so that we could grow mangoes and papaya in our climate. And so I really like this concept because as Asian Americans, we rely heavily on medicinal plants, plants that we have to take care of even the winters. If not, then we're going to have to source it from warmer cities and states. And so this would actually be an answer to some of the challenges we have as Asian American who rely heavily on medicinal herbs throughout the winter. So good luck. Thank you.
Any other member comments or questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tabke, interesting program. Kind of unusual, the funding is going to go directly to the university. So why isn't this part of the university's budget or a bonding request? Why is the Ag Committee funding directly to the university for this type of project?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. So that's a great question. So this is a legislatively led project. So this is not something that's a direct request from the University of Minnesota, but have been working with the Extension services for the last 4 years on the ideas and the plans around this, and we need some funding in order to make sure that this goes forward so we can get the next couple of iterations and make sure that this makes sense for a larger scale production side.
Representative Anderson. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. So did I hear you correct? Did you just say roughly $26,000 is what it takes to build one of these?
Representative Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Jacob, yes.
Okay.
Representative
Jacob. And the ask is for $1.2
million? Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair, Representative Jacob, $1.48 million.
Okay, so that comes up to well over $200,000 per unit?
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair and Representative Jacob, per...
Well, you said six.
Yep, so it's $26,000 per unit, six units, $180,000.
Okay, so where does the remain, the balance of the money go?
Yep, so there...
Representative to have
the lion's share of the money, where is it going?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Jacob, so what this is six built across the state, a seventh one built at the U of M on the organic farm, plus... with that, there is staffing for them, so we can make sure to get the research done and make sure that we have all the numbers correct. So I'll just lay it out for you. So the six at 180, the on-campus work plus labor is $1.1 million, and then additional needs on the organic farm in order to make sure that this works there is $200,000, so $1.48 million.
Representative Jacob?
Okay. So roughly $182,000 to build the units, and then more than $1 million for them to function.
Representative Tapke.
Madam Chair, Representative Jacob. So
correct.
That it's mostly correct. It's close enough. Yes, in order to do the research, in order to make sure that we have all the data we need, because there's a lot of work being done around these types of things in the so the Extension Regional Sustainable Development Division of Extension has six areas across the state of Minnesota. It does not include the metro, and so they are working on more sustainable development and throughout the state, and so this is a part of what we want to make sure to get done there.
Representative Jacob, final follow-up.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. When you talked about building the six facilities around the state, would these be on private land or at university research centers, or where would these be built?
Representative Tapke.
Chair Purcell and Representative Anderson, it would be a competitive process to see where it makes the most sense. Like, the goal of this is to, like, folks who have CSAs and who have small farms throughout the state of Minnesota. They have summer production, but then during the winter, there's no cash coming in, as we've talked a lot about, or significantly reduced amount of cash coming in. And so this would help make a full season process for this. And they have been amazed at the fact that the ones that have been built today, the month of, was it December or January for the heating?
December,
which was really, really cold in December here. It only cost $250 to heat it for the entire month of December. And so it's extremely efficient and will do a great job.
Representative Anderson, kind of follow up.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Well, so the state would build these and then let people use them on a rental basis or free of charge, or how would that all work?
Representative Tapke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that, Representative Anderson, so that is, when this gets funded, we'll have to figure out exactly, it will go to the Extension folks to figure out exactly how the program will be implemented and the rules around it as we generally do. So, yeah, that will be to be decided as when the competitive program process will be decided as well. So those will all get figured out as it moves forward.
Representative Tapke, closing remarks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something that I'm... hopefully you can tell, I'm really excited about. There's a lot of really great potential. This kind of this was all kind of reinvigorated this past fall when there was a significant amount of discussion on Twitter from some prominent politicians about the fact that we didn't have lettuce in fast food restaurants and that kind of thing. And so we have supply chain issues, and we wouldn't have supply chain issues for this type of product if we were producing locally, and we would be able to have enough food to go around for everyone and be able to have it where we need it at that time. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I appreciate everyone's time.
And Representative Tapke, would you like to renew your motion?
Yeah, I renew my motion for this to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Thank you. Representative Tapke renews his motion for House File 2288 to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. Representative Frederick, to your bill. It's settled. Representative Frederick, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 695 be laid over for a in the committee's future, possibly for the in the All right, let's start over.
All right.
I move that House File 695 be laid over in for a future omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully, this will go smoother. Green Team is an organization dedicated to strategically building and connecting southern Minnesota's extensive agricultural business assets in order to develop and position the entire region to be known nationally and internationally as a place for talent, business innovation, education in relation to agriculture. And I know we're on limited time, so I'm just going to kick it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. First testifier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Purcell and members. My name is Sam Ziegler. I'm president of GreenSeam. I want to thank you today for letting me come before you and talk about our organization. GreenSeam is a nonprofit organization that was founded in 2014 to promote the region as a world-class food and agribusiness epicenter. At our core, we're focused on economic development, targeting the full agriculture supply chain, which consists of retaining and expanding existing businesses, creating and attracting new businesses, talent development, and creating awareness to establish a brand destination for the industry cluster that exists today. Lake Silicon Valley nationally, or the Destination Medical Center within the state of Minnesota, would be an example of that destination. We currently have guidance, insight, and action from more than 54 volunteers, from high tech to professional services to educational institutions, and including Minnesota Department of Ag Commissioner Bailey. GreenSeam is focused on the four areas of work: business creation and community and business expansion, talent development, branding, as I mentioned. We believe in supporting entrepreneurs who have ideas which will make an impact on our state, and they often will stay in the area if they're already from here. And a note that 85% of a community's growth is from businesses which already exist. It comes from National Ag Economic Development Statistics. Two success stories were a critical element in is Minnesota State University Mankato, since it was established in 1868, has never had an agriculture program. This has now changed, and they now offer 2 degrees in ag, an ag business major and an ag engineering minor. Mankato is also a regional hub of food and ag, and for 25 years ago, the high school program was cut from the public school, the ag program. And I'm excited to report it's back and it's making an impact, and you'll get to hear about this more in a little bit. From branding and promotion, we're sharing the amazing stories of our region and why we are the solution center for food and ag in the U.S., as often Minnesota businesses are pretty humble, and we need to tell that story because nobody else is going to tell it for us. So one question I often get and would just like to address is how we plan to use the dollars from the state of Minnesota. The investment we use to activate and expand our support of business growth, talent development, and marketing our state's ag industry cluster. This will allow dollars to support time to mentor and provide expertise to entrepreneurs and businesses to increase their odds of success as a startup. Enhances the ability for us to connect with businesses who are in the region and find out ways to help strengthen them. One of those ways, we built out a robust business directory that connects anyone that's in the food and ag with on our business directory. And allows us to access data resource tools that we can turn around and help and assist the communities and businesses with information and allow them to make better informed decisions. We advocate for all sizes and types of businesses to invest in Minnesota who are also a part of the food and ag supply chain. GreenSeam is proud to say that we have 100% retention of businesses who decide to commit and support us with private funding 4 years ago. And we're in a great public-private partnership to help grow our rural communities. Currently, we are leveraging the state's investment 10 to 1. You can see that note in the back of the handout that was in your packet. In conclusion, GreenSeam is dedicated to ensuring that agriculture will fuel economic growth in Minnesota and is committed to developing this region to be known nationally and internationally as a place for talent, business innovation, and education related to agriculture. I'm proud to have direct supporters here today and have them talk about their experiences. Ethan Dotto, an ag teacher at Mankato School, and one of his students. And please note there are some information in your packet showcasing that work, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. So thank you for allowing me this time to present on behalf of GreenSeam today and your consideration regarding this as an important investment in agriculture and economic development. And thank you for each one of you that have had the opportunity to personally meet and would welcome a deeper conversation from anybody that I have not had the opportunity yet. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ziegler. Our next testifier, as you mentioned, is with us but remotely. So Ethan Dotto, please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ethan Dotto. I serve as one of the agriculture, food, and natural resource teachers here in Mankato Area Public Schools, and actually coming to you live from my classroom. Couldn't escape this kiddos today. And so have the honor and privilege to teach courses such as Intro to Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources, Egg Mechanics and Technology, a new course called Solving World Hunger, and my personal favorite, our plant science course. One of the topics we teach about in plant science is plant systems and plant structure. And one really unique thing about plants is they have equal mass above ground and below ground. And so when we look at those trees, they have just as much root structure below that surface as we see above. And now, the showy parts that we get to see, the leaves, the foliage, the flowers on many trees, that's the shiny, showy parts. That's what we get to do here as a classroom and as an agricultural education department. It's that root system below ground, partners like GreenSeam that allow us to shine. Now, 4 years ago, I had the privilege of starting this program after much behind-the-scenes work by GreenSeam. In our first year, we offered one course in our department, which enrolled 40 students. 4 short years later, we've added a second teacher, added 8 additional courses, and now see over 400 students on an annual basis. We're creating agricultural literate and informing consumers, designing and developing career-ready skills, and creating citizens that are problem solvers and critical thinkers. None of this would be possible without the initial work and continued support of Sam Ziegler and the greater GreenSeam team. And so for these reasons, I ask for your support for House File 695. And with that, I will actually pass it over to one of my students who is honored and excited to be here to share today, Matthew Borman.
Thank you, Mr. Dotto. Our student testifier, please identify yourself before the committee and begin your testimony.
My name is Matthew Borman. For the record, Brynn was supposed to speak had a conflict. I am a senior at Mankato West High School and have been an active member of Mankato Agricultural Education and FFA for the last 4 years. During this time, I have grown my skills as a speaker, leader, and agriculturalist. In the future, I will use these skills as an electrical engineer while capitalizing on my leadership skills. Without this program, I would not be entering with as much confidence, experience, nor network. This would not be possible without the GreenSeam organization, and I ask for your funding to continue expanding programs like those I was able to participate in. I appreciate being able to share my experience with you and ask for your support of House File 695.
Thank you, Mr. Borman. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. Seeing no member discussion, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because I got flustered over my words at the beginning, what I meant to say as well was a thank you to Madam Chair for signing on, along with Representative Harder for being supporters of the bill. So thank you for that. And with that, I guess I would just say I appreciate the committee's support, and I move that House File 695 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Ag Finance and Policy Omnibus.
Thank you, Representative renews his motion, and the bill is laid over. Next up, Representative Burkle. When you are ready, Representative, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1606 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. And you may proceed. Tell us about your bill.
So House File 1606 is a bill that simply appropriates $75,000 each year for the next biennium to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to be used as a pass-through grant to the Minnesota Turf Seed Council, which is located in the city of Roseau in my district. The appropriation must be used to continue basic and applied crop research. This appropriation has been made in each of the last several bienniums, but has never been made part of the department's base budget, so introducing a separate bill is necessary every other year. The bill also requires that the council submit a report on how the funds were used to the chairs and ranking members of AI Finance and Policy Committees by January 15th of 2025. With me today is Marv Zutz, I think online, if I'm not mistaken, the executive director of the Minnesota Turf Seed Council, and he'll tell you a little bit more about the bill. I also have Bruce Clavin here if we have any questions.
Thank you, Representative Burkle. We will move to Mr. Zutz if you are able to identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony remotely.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Marvin Zutz, Executive Director of the Minnesota Turf Seed Council. The Minnesota Turf Seed Council is comprised of a group of farmers, processors, and businesses that represent the turf seed industry in Northwest Minnesota. The grass seed industry in Northern Minnesota has a long history of turf seed production, starting with the initial appropriation of $35,000 to the University of Minnesota from the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Commission in 1948. To help develop the grass and legume seed industry. The investment helped the University of Minnesota to develop the park variety of Kentucky bluegrass, the very first winter hardy variety that could survive the harsh Minnesota winters. The success of the bluegrass industry started the production of many other species, including timothy, red top, red clover, bird's foot trefoil, perennial ryegrass, and most recently, the fescues. In 1998, the University of Minnesota received a gift of 40 acres from Mrs. Peggy Magnuson for a permanent research farm dedicated to grass and legume seed at Roseau. The University of Minnesota, in cooperation with the Minnesota Turf Seed Council, built a structure on the farm that houses equipment and provides office space for the seed production research project. Three grass seed processing companies employing 40 workers have been created in Roseau County to clean and sort the seed for market. The grasses contribute approximately $175 million of economic activity in the region. The production of these seeds is very environmentally friendly. Some of these species are perennials and produce seed for four or five years. Consequently, the soil is not disturbed for years, and there is growth all growing season to prevent nutrient runoff. The seed produced from fields in northern Minnesota goes on to help solve environmental problems across the nation and the world. These seeds are used for mine reclamation, prairie restoration, levee stabilization, nutrient filters, along with many other uses. Perennial ryegrass is a relative newcomer to the region and is used on lawns and golf courses. Production acres numbered less than 1,000 acres in 2001 and have increased every year since. In 2023, we expect to harvest 60,000 acres of perennial ryegrass in the area. The only thing that seems to be growing faster than ryegrass acres is the number of research questions relating to ryegrass production. Producers continue to depend on the Turf Council and the University of Minnesota to answer these questions. Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the opportunity to appear before your committee today, and I would be pleased to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Zutz. Is there anyone else who would care to testify for or against the bill? Then we will move to member discussion and questions. Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Burkle, for bringing this, having extensive background in landscape and horticulture, I know, and lawn care. This is really important for what happens in the lawn care industry and also the future transition from just bluegrass turf to more sustainable turf and perennial grasses and those kinds of things. So thank you very much for bringing this and fully support the project.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thinking back, earlier this year, there were some folks down here from golf courses in Minnesota, and they mentioned that this ryegrass took less water to establish and grow, and so it's really a good addition to what they do up there in your area in growing grass seeds. So is that kind of replacing the Kentucky bluegrass on golf courses, or are they both still pretty popular, Representative, in terms of their use in golf courses?
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that question, Representative Anderson. I think both are being used, but I think, you know, given the climate we have, and maybe Mr. Zoot's going to answer this with a little more definity, but I think it is taking up some of that volume.
Mr. Zoot, you are still with us over Zoom. Did you hear the question, and would you be able to respond?
Madam Chair, Representative
Anderson,
I believe. Kentucky bluegrass acres have shrunk of recent. Perennial grass has substituted for the Kentucky bluegrass in most lawn mixtures, and especially for the golf courses down in southern United States, when the Bermuda ryegrass turns brown and goes dormant in the winter. We interseed those courses now with perennial ryegrass. And that's the reason why these golf tournaments are able to continue during the winter now. So when you watch the Tour of Champions and stuff like that, this is perennial ryegrass, primarily from northern Minnesota, that's allowing these golf courses.
Thank you, Mr. Zoots. Other member discussion or questions? Thank you so much, Representative Burkle. Any closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nothing. I'll get things moving along quickly here, but I just renew my motion to lay this over for possible inclusion.
Thank you so much. Representative Burkle renews his motion to lay over the bill, and the bill is laid over. And our final bill that we will be hearing this afternoon is House File 2563, Representative Cha. When you are ready, Representative Cha, if you would like to move your bill before the committee.
Yes, I would, Chair Purcell, to move HF 2563.
Thank you. The bill is before us. For possible inclusion in our omnibus bill, please proceed with your bill introduction.
Thank you. Before I start with my talking points, I want to explain my challenges as being a farmer. There's a need in my community for processing meats, and because we are a immigrant and refugee community, the processing of certain meats had to be done by culture or tradition. And you know, a lot of our cultural rituals included the butchering of cows for our ancestors and for our deceased. That means that somebody like myself, if my grandma was to pass away, I had to butcher 8 to 10 cows to offer to my mother, which I could not get at a grocery store. And so these challenges led me to the path of being a small farmer, where I raise heifers, steers, and bulls, and other animals as goats, Berkshire hogs, and chickens. The challenges in those industry always came down to processing, whether it was grass-fed cattle farmers or small-time chicken farmers. You know, that contributed to the cost of the units of production, which didn't make it affordable for others to access and purchase. Just to give you an idea, I was butchering about 45 heads of steers or cattle per week for my community at the time. And I raised about 200 heads of heifers and steers on top of the Berkshire hogs and chickens that I raised during that time over a 10-year period. With that, I'm going to go into the talking points of this bill, HF 2563, and the importance of it for our producers. I'm glad to present HF 2563, which would provide additional support to the Agri-Value-Added Program for meat and poultry processing. This is the MDA's flagship grant program to support meat and poultry processors as they work to modernize equipment, expand their operation, or start new plants. This program has a strong record and was included in the governor's budget. My bill would add an additional $3 million to this program over the biennium. Broadly, this committee should care about investing in local and regional meat processing for a few important reasons. First, farmers need these plants to get livestock to market, and unfortunately, they're experiencing a severe shortage of processing access. I think about new farmers, livestock is a great way to start, but only if we can get it to processing. Second, as a farm, as with farms, many processors are reaching retirement age. A big barrier for them is transitioning their plants to next generation is the age and the condition of their equipment. If we can help them modernize now, we can ensure there will be around for the next generation. Finally, farmers, consumers, and workers aren't served well by a consolidated system. The four largest meat packers control 54% of the poultry processing, 66% of pork packing, and 85% of beef packing. 98% of beef cattle are processed at just 50 plants across the U.S. We can shorten supply chain, build resiliency, and create good-paying jobs for supporting our local processors. Now for a bit about the program. Agri-value added grants are issued to a competitive basis and require a 50% match up to $50,000. Above $50,000, the grantee is responsible for a 75% match with a maximum grant award of $150,000. Individuals, business, cooperatives, and others can apply to invest in equipment or physical improvements that support processing capacity, market diversification, and market access. Excuse me. Last year, grants went to Longcheng in Representative Hansen's district to help process chicken. Now, let me tell you what the importance of Longcheng is to the Asian or immigrant community in Minnesota. For decades, they have allowed processing of cattle, hogs, and chicken at this facility. Just to give an idea, when a person gives birth in my community to a child, they have to go on a 30-day chicken diet. And we're not just talking about Tyson chicken from your local market. We're talking about jungle fowl or fresh-killed chicken that will be butchered and slaughtered and kept for 30 days as a chicken diet to replenish a woman's body. And I'm also happy to mention that this diet is now included at the hospitals here in the cities. So for many decades, facility serve our community really, really well. And thank goodness for the whiz bang chicken plucker, right? Yeah. So anyways. And to Jennings Meat Processing, which also received these grant and represent Anderson's district to help them purchase their new rail system to make their work more efficient. This successful program that has carried and earned the committee support in the past session has made it easier for all these producers and processors. And we hope to see this done again this year. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cha. Our first testifier, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Morgan Tao. I'm the owner and operator of Concord Fresh Meat Processing. And thank you for chairman and committee members for giving me the opportunity to testify here. As you know, we've been dealing with livestock for 20 years, and I went through the H1N1 pandemic and the COVID-19 pandemic, so I was looking for an opportunity to expand the custom services into equal to facility, and I was able to, with this grant and this program, I was able to obtain a reefer truck that I can deliver, like Representative Chan said, 10 to 12 cows to funeral homes in a safe environment to the communities. was also to transport we call halal meat to the Muslim community. So with these programs, I will be able to provide more services to the immigrant community. So I support Representative Charles H-2563's bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tao. Our next testifier is remote. Hannah Bernhardt, if you identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Hannah Bernhardt, and I run Medicine Creek Farm in Finlayson, where we raise pastured beef, pork, and lamb. I'm a member of Minnesota Farmers Union, and on behalf of myself and the organization, I'm glad to share my strong support of House File 2563. I'm also a member of the Emerging Farmers Working Group, and one commonality of many emerging farmers is that we're highly likely to be direct marketing all of our products. And as such, for emerging livestock farmers, we rely solely on our local meat processors to be able to bring our livestock to market, and their success is inextricably linked to our own. So I'm equally invested in making sure meat processing plants are up to date because it gives me more options and flexibility as a producer. My customers want value-added products, and helping processors buy equipment that allows them to make more sausages, galled hogs, or vacuum seal cuts is just a few examples, makes my farm more attractive to my customers. And as mentioned, due to the bottleneck in meat processing, the more new meat processors we can support as a state, the more emerging farmers we can help to get started and grow their businesses. And finally, you know, as also mentioned, much like farms, many processes are reaching the time for a generational transition. And this funding helps pass these businesses on to the next generation, ensuring that there's a future for my farm business as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bernhardt. Any other testifiers in the audience who care to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions or comments. Representative Anderson.
You know I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, thanks for being here. Your work sounds interesting. Could you give us some idea of how many people work in your plant and some of the work you do? And just how big are some of these plants? And also the testifier on video, she could tell us the size of some of the plants she's talking about as well.
Let's begin with Mr. Tao.
I have about 8 people working in the plant.
Thank you. And Ms. Bernhardt?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't know for certain, but I think that, you know, it is a small processor. I use Lake Haven Meats in Sturgeon Lake. You know, I think they're doing maybe around 10 steers a week would be my guess. I know that when I do my lamb, I think the max I'm able to bring in one day for them to process is 20 lambs at one time.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you again. Yeah, thanks for those comments. And again, I think when we talk about incenting the expansion of meat processing, you know, just last week we heard a bill that may kind of curtail the expansion of meat processing. And I think the bill we heard last week, the Wokamot bill, had a ceiling of 50. So these seem to be well under that threshold of 50. But again, we're, I think, kind of sending mixed messages on one. And I support your bill, Representative, to do this. But then on the other hand, when they get up to this 45 or 50 person employment, then we're going to clamp regulations on them that the people that did testify said it would drive them out of business. So I think we need to be careful in terms of the messages we send, who we incent, and who we make more difficult in what they do. But again, I support your bill, Representative Cha.
Representative Cha?
Thank you, Representative Anderson, for that comment, and I agree with you. You know, we have to be careful about how we write these policies. You know, to these small producers, I don't think they're looking to expand to have a huge operation. It's kind of like a niche thing. And I'm sure Mr. Tao has had 8 employees for the last 30 years. So thank you.
Additional questions or comments from the committee? Chair Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Chow for bringing this bill forward, and thank you to Morgenthau for testifying here today in today's Agriculture Committee. Lo Jiang has been a long-time community gem for not just the Hmong community, for many immigrant communities, and continues to be throughout the state. And so thank you, Morgenthau, for your contributions to the state as well.
Thank you, Representative Vang. Any other comments, questions? Seeing none, Representative Chow to close.
Yes, first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Hansen for continuously advocating for Long Chang and processors. And, I am State Representative 47B, but on behalf of my community, as leader of my community, of the Hmong community, I want to extend the thank you from the elders to your work and this committee in the past for continued supporting Long Chang and other markets. I want to thank Lead Anderson and Representative Nelson and Purcell, all of you, for being co-authors on this bill. And thank you for the opportunity to present this House File 2563 on this committee. And with that, I would like to renew my motion to possible inclusion.
Thank you. Representative Chow renews his motion for House File 2563 to be included potentially in our agriculture omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Before we adjourn, Representative Vang to an announcement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I want to ask all of you to, if you guys would be willing to stay an extra couple of minutes after members of the public has left the room, and I will just have a quick announcement to everyone.
Thank you, and we will be just in recess until 6 o'clock p.m. We will not be in this room. We will be in the State Office Building Room 200. We'll see you at 6 o'clock. We are in recess. I call the agriculture meeting to order on March 16. Nope. March 6. Calling it back to order. Calling us back to order. So the first bill that we have for the 6 p.m. committee hearing is House File 2562, Representative Sansomira, on the Commission of Agriculture funding provided for grants to partner organizations on meat and poultry processors. Whenever you're ready, if you could please move your bill.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I would actually like to start by offering an oral amendment.
Okay. Go ahead.
So as introduced, the bill currently 25 in front of you, House File 2562, does not have an appropriation. I would like to add an appropriation. So this would be on line 2.8. And the appropriation should be $500,000 per year. So $500,000 in fiscal year 2024 and $500,000 in fiscal year 2025.
Okay. So Representative Sansomira moves an oral amendment to line 2.8. Colby, Mr. Sullivan, would you like to confirm the change?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to restate the oral amendment to House File 2562. It's on page 2, line 8. Delete the first ellipsis and insert $500,000, and delete the second ellipsis and also insert $500,000.
All right. Discussion to the oral amendment. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill author, did you just get the fiscal note with those numbers?
So this is, thank you, Lead Anderson, for the question. So there is no fiscal note for this. This is just an appropriation. But this bill has already been heard in the Senate with that amount included. This would be an appropriation from the general fund to the Commissioner of Agriculture to give out $500,000 a year in these grants.
Representative Anderson. Okay. Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The ayes have it. The oral amendment is adopted.
to your bill as amended. Representative Sensenmera.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm glad to be presenting House File 2562, which builds on the legislature's work to strengthen our state's local and regional meat processing system in the wake of COVID-19. I appreciate this, that we're able to hear this proposal along with proposals from Representative Cha and Representative Nelson as the committee considers how to support an industry that is so important to farmers and to our communities at large. My bill aims to take the next step in rebuilding our meat processing workforce, a central challenge for small and regional processing plants. When the big consolidated packing plants closed during the height of COVID-19 because workers were getting sick, the only flex in the system was the local and regional lockers. And while livestock was backing up, MDA, volunteers of the university, and others went and talked with these small businesses about what they needed to expand and be able to serve more farmers. The single most limiting factor to expansion was lack of a skilled workforce. In response to this, the legislature and federal government helped start technical training programs for meat cutting and butchery at Central Lakes and Ridgewater Colleges in Staples and Wilmar. Chair Vang and others were a key part of that work. My bill now seeks to build on that effort by offering funding for scholarships, relocation assistance, childcare stipends, and other expenses that will help new employees access the technical training programs to get started within this industry. What we know from the colleges is that people are excited about these careers, but finding a way to get started can be a challenge, and this program can help address that. This program would help administer grants to nonprofits and regional development organizations who are already engaged in this work. And importantly, under this program, they would have funding to work directly with new employees, providing translation services, matching with employers, and otherwise ensuring that new employers have what they need to be successful in this industry. Under this proposal, no individual could receive more than $10,000, and employees at no one processor could receive more than $50,000. This proposal is modeled after one brought forward by the governor last session, and it reflects recommendations in the Meat Processing Bottleneck Report. I did have testifiers from colleges, a small meat locker, and a local development organization who was eager to administer this program, but unfortunately they were going to testify remotely, and we don't have that capacity within this room. There is a packet of letters within your packet with their testimony, so I would encourage you all to look through that. But second best thing, we do have testifier Stu Laurie here who can help talk a little bit further about this program.
All right, Stu Laurie, please identify yourself before the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang and members of the committee. I'm glad to be the second best thing. And my name is Stu Laurie. I'm Government Relations Director for Minnesota Farmers Union. And I want to thank Representative Sensenmera for carrying this bill that I think is a meaningful next step to the work that this committee has done to rebuild the meat processing workforce across the state. As Representative Sensenmera said, during COVID-19, when the large packing plants went down, small processors across the state were the remaining kind of flex in the system that could serve producers. And the department went around and they knocked on their doors and said, hey, could we buy you another meat slicer? Could we help you get more cold storage? What can we do to help you expand your capacity? And their answer was, hey, it's just, you know, me and my kid, or it's me and two employees. We really need to, get more folks into these careers and expand workforce opportunities. So that's what this committee did. But in talking to the colleges and the other workforce partners across the state, there's still a gap in helping students find their way into these career programs and then find success in the colleges. And so Blondie's Butcher Shop has written testimony about how hard it is for her to find employees. West Central Initiative Foundation is eager to administer these grants, as is Region 5. With private funding, LEDC is actually led in doing some of this work previously. And Central Lakes College and Ridgewater College are also really excited to accept more students on scholarships from this program. So thank you so much for hearing this proposal and for accepting my testimony in lieu of folks who would have been much more compelling and interesting, I'm sure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Sue. Any further testifiers for this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to discussion to the bill. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Sensenmira, you know, thank you for bringing this forward, and I think it's you know, kind of continued work on this that, you know, a much needed area. And in the Workforce Committee last evening, we heard of a somewhat similar proposal that's happening in the Midwest campus, is trying to somewhat mirror the offer that South Dakota has on really trying to get some of our workforce to move to South Dakota. They provide education, and then that's, you know, there's a scholarship there, but then you've got to live in South Dakota for 3 years, which I don't know if that's good or bad, but it sounds windy to me. You know, I think one of these things that I think maybe we could work on this, you know, would be a little bit of a requirement on the backside of this. You know, when you, if you get a grant, that, you know, would require some time on there. You know, I support the bill, I support the idea, but I think maybe if there could be something, a little bit of a guardrail there. But overall, I think it's a great idea on trying to, you know, really help this area that is needed. So.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Nelson. You know, also sit on the Workforce Committee, and I was thinking, you know, a similar thing. I think this is a needed approach to get folks into the careers that we're having a harder time getting people into. But I will turn it over to my testifier, who I think also has some comments about your suggestion.
Mr. Lord.
Thank you, Chair Vang and members of the committee. One thing I was just going to say, and this was my fault in not getting Representative Sensenmira the information that she needed previously, but one amendment that the Senate made that I think speaks to yours is actually changing the sign-on bonuses to retention bonuses, which I think speaks to some of that buy-in. I think the bottleneck report, a lot of meat processors said, hey, we really don't want, you know, bonuses for folks signing up. We want a bonus when they, you know, are employed by us for a length of time. And I think that's one way that, as this bill is laid over, you might be able to address that with the chairs and the authors' permission.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill author, Representative Sensenmira, in the past, I think the Department of Ag has done some of these granting, these grants, and you're going through, I think what the bill says, partner organizations to assist these processors. Why the middle step in this, and wouldn't we be better off just going directly from MDA to the lockers themselves?
Representative Sensenmira.
Yeah, I think I can speak to that a little bit, and then I don't know if my testifier can add something. You know, so this bill, you know, was kind of created based on a few different groups kind of working together, especially groups that are really based, I think, in communities of color and communities where maybe there are people that are eager to enter this field but have things like language barriers as a barrier to entry. And so, you know, I think these trusted community organizations that already have the relationship with folks might, you know, be a better kind of conduit to get people into these programs than people that just don't have a relationship currently with MDA. But I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
Yeah, I might just say this is building on a proposal that was brought forward by MDA and the governor last session, where they recommended running these through partner organizations. I think the idea is exactly that they're the ones doing that work and have those relationships on the ground. I know in this meat processing work, we've done a lot with Region 5 Development Commission. LEDC has been doing a lot to place meat processing employees. That's why this model was chosen, was building off of that proposal that was brought forward last session.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So will they be getting an administrative fee for their work in doing this? It doesn't specify that in the bill.
Representative Sensenmira.
I believe so. I think I might be a tiny bit confused just because we did have an amendment that didn't end up making it. Okay, but yes, on line 2.4. Yeah.
I can speak to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll let my testifier speak.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Vang. So the Department of Agriculture will request and did request, and we didn't get the amendment in, to allow them their regular up to 6.5% to administer the program. The partner organizations would apply and would be able to use up to 20% of their grant award to provide direct technical assistance. So translation services, direct liaisoning with plants and helping match employees with employers, doing that kind of work to make sure that we're getting our bang for our buck and our investment in the technical colleges programs and in this program.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Well, it seems a little bit steep. We're looking at about 26.5% admin fees on $1 million. That's a lot of money that could be going directly to the workers or prospective workers, and it's going to be eaten up in admin costs. But I'll leave that there. The other question I had, Madam Chair, if I could, to the bill author. According to House research, this bill is targeted at the small to medium-sized plants, processing plants. Tell us what size plants you're looking to give this assistance to.
Representative Sensenmiro.
Yeah, so I think actually there's been some technical advice from the department to clarify that definition to just eligible processor, and I believe that these are... Yes, I think that's just the language I'll be using, eligible processor. Representative Anderson?
I didn't hear your answer. Could you repeat that again, please?
Yeah, so I think that we are going to change the language, or our intention is to change the language, and the Senate has changed the language from small to medium size to eligible processor, and I think that the definition is up to 150 employees.
Representative Anderson?
On line 1.17, it says fewer than 150. Would that be your intention?
Yes.
Well, again, Madam Chair, I just have to reiterate that we're hearing bills that place some potentially costly restrictions on meat processors with over 50 employees. And now here on this hand, we're incentivizing processes up to 150 employees, and then turning around on the other side and putting regulations on them that, again, back in committee, a couple of them said would put us out of business. So, I think we need to have the message that we know what we're doing, and, you know, incentivizing these processors and not actually regulating them out of business. So I'm just cautious and curious about how we are sending a mixed message to these processors in that 100 to 150 range, actually 50 to 150 range, that we're sending them a mixed message, and I think that's concerning.
Okay. Any further discussion? Closing remarks, Representative Sensenmiro?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the discussion, you know, and Lead Anderson, open to continued conversations. One of the things that I think about with the impact of this bill is just all the conversations we have about, you know, farmers that are reaching retirement age and how do we bring more people into the field? How do we support emerging farmers? I think that this can be a key program for ensuring, for helping to ensure that these brick and mortar businesses across our state can continue into the next generation and that everyone has an opportunity to be an entrepreneur in this important sector. So I'm proud to carry this bill, and I hope to have continued conversations and earn your support for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
All right. Representative Sensenmiro renews her motion that House File 2562 is laid over for possible inclusion. House File 2562 is laid over. The next bill we have is House File 2278, Board of Animal Health Funding. Representative Vang, when you are ready, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2278 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Vang. And there, we'll begin with the A1 amendment. This is the author's amendment, if you would introduce that before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment is a technical change, just to clarify that it's ongoing appropriation.
Okay. Discussion to the A1 amendment. Okay, seeing no discussion, we will vote on the adoption of the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. We also have an A2 amendment, which I believe comes from Representative Anderson. Would you care to discuss the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Just some clarification here, and calling for some, as we like to say, guardrails and reporting aspects to the increased funding we give them. So it just requires some additional reporting, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay, Representative Vang to the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson, for your amendment, and I ask members to support the amendment.
Any additional discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing none, voting on the A2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Vang, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is an agency bill. It's regarding funding of the Animal Board of Animal Health to help cover increased costs associated with importation of companion animals. That is, I believe I have my testifier here who can talk more in details about the bill.
All right. Thank you. Once you are settled, please state your name and share with us your testimony.
Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Marion Garcia. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Animal Health.
You may proceed.
Okay, regarding Section A, as countless countries across the world experience animal diseases such as rabies and African swine fever, the Board of Animal Health has had to adjust the process for accepting companion animal imports to protect the health of Minnesota's animal populations. When someone inquires about bringing an animal from one of the countries with large outbreaks of rabies and ASF, as listed in the World Organization for Animal Health's website, there's extra documentation required ahead of the import. The process often requires a quarantine upon arrival to Minnesota. This funding would assist in covering the increased expenditures that have developed over the years, including staff time, communications to the public, and allow the field staff to inspect the quarantines.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other testifiers? Anyone in the audience care to testify for or against this bill? Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Clavin, I represent Minnesota Turkey Growers and the North Central Poultry Association. I signed up to testify just to let the members know on the record that we support the bill, the back funding on the emergency response account. As you've heard earlier in the session, avian flu is very much on the growers' mind, and it's March 16th, and any day now we could start receiving disease alerts. So they just want me to go on the record supporting the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other testifiers? Seeing none, discussion to the bill as amended, members. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Vang, the governor has proposed an operating increase for the Board of Animal Health. That's not part of this bill. Is it part of a different funding bill that we're going to be hearing from the board in a later bill?
Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe later in committee when we'll hear the governor's budget bill, and I believe MDA can cover a portion of that. Yeah.
Any other discussion or questions to the bill as amended? Okay, seeing none, Representative Vang, would you like to close and re-renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. And I would just renew my motion that House File 2278 be laid over for possible inclusion as amended.
Representative Bang renews her motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. The motion passes and House File 2278 is laid over. Our next bill also comes from Representative Vang, House File 1361. Representative Vang, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Your bill and then introduce it.
Yes, I move my bill, House File 1361, be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 1361 continues on the theme of land access. It appropriates from the general fund to the Commissioner of Ag to certified community development financial institutions that participate in the USDA loan or grant programs for small or emerging farmers, including but not limited to increasing land capital and market access program. This is a response to USDA's new program to increase access to land, capital, and market. Although USDA provides this critical funding to farmers, the institutions that provide the technical assistance to help farmers apply is a gap not funded by the program, USDA program. So with this bill, it will enable more farmers to be serviced by institutions to apply for this program. And I have my testifier here today who can talk more to the bill.
Okay, we have two amendments to discuss perhaps before we go to testimony. So I believe Representative Jacob, if you would please move the A1 amendment and explain it.
Sure, I'll move the A1 amendment. So essentially the A1 amendment just would require CDFIs that receive grants under the section that they must report the grant outcomes to the commissioner, and then it establishes a timeline for doing so. So this really just adds accountability to the bill and gathers information to enhance the program in the future. I think it's a good amendment.
Thank you, Representative Jacob. Representative Fang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Jacob, for the amendment. I think it is reasonable to require reporting. However, the federal program already requires reporting and sometimes require more information. So I will ask members to oppose the amendment as I don't want it to be redundant in, to the organizations that are already utilizing the USDA's programs.
Any other discussion to the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, we will vote on adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay.
Nay. Nay.
The motion does not pass and the A1 amendment is not adopted. We have a second amendment to the bill. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Vice Chair Purcell. Chair Vang, so my motion, on the bill at the end, it defines what exactly a small farmer is, and that language I got from the USDA website. It was difficult to find anything else. And we see a lot of bills coming through that talk about small or emerging farmers, but small farmers, nothing that I can find really details what exactly that is. So that would be my motion.
Thank you, Representative Harder. Representative Bank.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Harder, for your amendment. I know we had a couple conversations about this, and I do think it's a reasonable amendment, and I think it's important to define definitions into law. However, there are also other definitions like beginning farmers, emerging farmers, that although are very similar, they're not the same. And so I don't want to unintentionally limit a farmer. And so therefore, we can continue to work on this amendment, and I will ask that for members to oppose.
Thank you. Any other discussion to the amendment?
Yes. May I?
Yes, Representative Harder.
Yes, we did have conversations on that, and those were good. Thank you very much. And I have other conversations that maybe we need to start looking at defining some of those terms so that as these bills come through that we have a clearer message as to what they are. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Harder. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would support the amendment. It seems to me we've had a lot of bills this week. It's been a long week. But it seems to me in the down payment assistance program or something, there was a notation that spoke to this level of income, $250,000. And to the purpose of this bill, this certainly, to me, would, in my mind, justify what a small farmer was, somebody with the income under that threshold. So I think it's reasonable, and I would support the amendment of Representative Harder.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I don't know if this is appropriate or to put you on the spot, but I'm wondering if House Research would be able to help us figure out where that came from and what definitions we do and don't have. And if you can't right now, that's okay.
Yep. Madam Chair, yeah, had a couple questions about this recently. If there is a definition in statute of small farmer, and there isn't one that I'm aware of. The example Representative Anderson just gave is there is an eligibility criteria for down payment assistance grants about, as the committee reviewed earlier this week or late last week, and an eligible farmer could only grow so much in income from the sale of farm products. So that's, I guess, sort of getting at this concept, as he mentioned, but I'm not aware of an actual definition that could be pointed to in a bill like this regarding what is or isn't a small farmer.
Thank you. That was very helpful, Mr. Sullivan. Appreciate that and putting you on the spot like that. Representative Vang, any additional comments or information? Any other discussion to the A2 amendment? All in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
No.
Nay. And the motion does not pass. So Representative Vang, to your bill, House File 1361, and you have a testifier at the table. If you would please identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Aaron Blythe. I'm the Director of Agriculture for the Latino Economic Development Center, LEDC. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1361. I'm here because I know farmers need access to better access to loans, and I think that CDFIs in Minnesota could play a major role in that. As a community development financial institution, LEDC last year supported about 1,100 clients with their entrepreneurial needs. In the last 5 years, LEDC has been able to lend to 136 businesses, patient and affordable capital that has accounted for $7 million and has leveraged nearly $15 million in additional funding for those businesses. Within the agricultural sector, we've been able to provide 44 agricultural loans worth about $790,000 to 32 individual farms. And that actually makes us one of the most active CDFI agricultural lenders in the country right now, surprisingly, but it's true. Since 2014, we've been an active authorized lender for the Rural Finance Authority of Minnesota for their microloan program and have accessed $168,000 through that program. And in 2020, we distributed $340,000 of MDA CARES Act money to about 47 BIPOC farmers and 133 BIPOC agricultural workers. We know that access to capital is a vital aspect of taking a farm from surviving to thriving. We also know that CDFIs have a strong record across many industries in being able to develop deep relationships within specific communities and geographic locations. So loans from our CDFI are more flexible, better designed to meet the needs of small farm borrowers than those from traditional banks and have far less barriers than traditional FSA loan programs. I think the land access program that Chair Vang talked about is FSA trying to address some of those issues, but there's still more needs within the community. In order to do this work, LEDC and other CDFIs need reliable access to funding for the technical assistance we provide to our clients. We're successful and the clients are successful because we go the extra mile with them. We often spend 40, 80 hours working with a single client to get them to loan readiness, and it costs us a lot to go that extra mile. This bill would provide CDFIs the funding needed to expand into agricultural work within Minnesota and be a model for CDFIs both in Minnesota and nationally for how CDFIs can play a vital role in the agricultural lending sphere. And thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers from the audience to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, you've been around a while making loans and just wondering about some of your loan procedures, amount of down payment, interest rates, that type of thing, number of failures in the years you've been doing this. So just give us some of the background on the work you've done.
Yeah, so overall, our loan manager will be able to talk more specifically to a lot of that, loan fund manager, but I know that we have a default rate of about 2.7% overall in the 13-year history of being a CDFI, which is lower than most banks from my understanding. The reason for that is because we have a relationship with the clients. I think the clients understand that we're giving them a hand up, working with them through each barrier. And so I think there's a little bit better understanding of both. We know if the client's having trouble and we can reach out and modify the loan if necessary. And also I think they have a more willingness to want to work with us because they know that we're helping them out. In terms of interest rates, it depends. We work with risky clients quite a bit. A lot of folks are coming to us because the traditional banks aren't going to lend to them, and so some of those folks end up with an interest rate of 8 or 9, 10% because of that, which is high, but it's because there's no one else that's going to lend them money. On average, the agricultural loans are more like 5 to 6%, which is well within the sphere. It'd be nice if they were FSA loans at 2%, but that's not possible right now. I think with funds like this, it would help us a lot to be able to lower some of our costs and subsidize some of that, which would, I think, be reflected on interest rates eventually.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that sounds pretty impressive, that low delinquency rate. Do you also offer training like farm business management? Or you didn't mention the amount of down payment needed when you do some of these loans.
So in terms of down payment with the loans, We don't, so often there'll be a sources and uses, so we're looking at where those sources are for the amount of money that they need. And we do ask normally that the client is putting something up that can be as little as $5,000 for a $50,000 loan. Sometimes it's nothing, sometimes it's more, it depends on the individual client. We do ask for collateral, although we can be flexible with what that collateral is. If we're doing cows, for example, or animals, it's kind of hard to do collateral on the animals, so we might do a collateral on a tractor instead or something like that.
Representative Cha.
My question was answered. Thank you.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. So how did they come up with the $1 million per year appropriation? What was the criteria for that?
Mr. Blythe. Or Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jacob, the $1 million is just a placeholder. I'm amenable to the number as well. So it's just a starting point, or it could be more or less. It's just a placeholder for now.
Okay. Representative Jacob.
How much less can it be?
Representative Vang.
I'll have that more defined as we continue to work with stakeholders. And Madam Chair, I believe Mr. Blythe would like to also add a comment.
Mr. Blythe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would say that for us as an individual CDFI, we would like to see at least $150,000 because that would cover one person plus all the sort of admin costs and some other extras. And so I think the idea was if this was a program that was going to support multiple CDFIs around the state, which I do think there's CDFIs that'd be very interested in this, then there'd be more money to split up between multiple CDFIs.
Thank you. Any additional discussion or questions to the bill? Representative Nelson.
Yeah, the CDFIs, are they kind of all over the state, or is it kind of, maybe give a little bit of an overview of that, of who they are, where they are located?
Mr. Blythe?
Yeah, so as far as I understand, there's 33 CDFIs in Minnesota. I think the vast majority of them are located within the Twin Cities, but they are rural as well. Some of the ones, I just wrote this down recently, some of the ones that I think would take advantage of this bill would be Shared Capital Cooperative, which works with co-ops around the country, but is based out of St. Paul. Twin Cities Community Land Bank would be another one. I think HAP, Hmong American Partnership, would be a possibility. Indian Land Capital Company is another one. Leech Lake has a CDFI. I know that they're talking about doing more with agriculture. and I'm sure there's others, but there are 33 out there, and I think there'd be plenty of interest in working in ag.
Thank you. I know closing comments. Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an important bill. It continues to address the barriers and challenges that many small farmers face towards getting access to land and capital. And so I appreciate the committee's time to hear this bill. And I renew my motion that House File 1361 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Vang renews her motion to lay over House File 1361 for potential inclusion in the omnibus bill, and it is laid over. We are going to move to Representative Vang's next bill, House File 2679. And when you are ready, Representative Vang, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that 2679 be laid over for possible inclusion. And this bill is the governor's budget priorities, and so I will ask the commissioner to walk through the bill, and they have a presentation as well.
Representative Vang, I believe your motion should be to refer to Ways and Means.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I renew my motion for House File 2279B. 2679B. We refer to Ways and Means.
Thank you. And to the presenters, once you get settled, please identify yourselves and begin your testimony.
Okay. Madam Chair, Tom Peterson, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we're glad to walk through the governor's agriculture Board of Animal Health, and there is a small piece for AURI in here, and so we'll walk through those. These are all pieces that you've heard in this committee. We've walked through these presentations previously, so we'll go through them kind of at a higher level, and glad to look at any of the other pieces as we go. Just a reminder that as we put this bill together, we took input from our own staff and our agencies, but then we also opened a portal for several months for Minnesotans to put issues in and ideas, and so this bill is really based on that, and then also based on the structural soundness financially for the department. So with that, with your consideration, I'm going to have our government director, Michelle Medina, walk through the PowerPoint.
Please identify yourself and go ahead. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you for the record. My name is Michelle Medina. I serve as Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And I'm no Deputy Commissioner Bobble, but I will try to go fast. Probably not quite as fast.
We're sorry. She is not feeling well tonight, and she was going to walk through this. So we're kind of like, but we're ready to go.
So. We got this. So starting on line 2.25 is the Soil Health Financial Assistance Program, which is $4 million for fiscal year 24 to 25, so $2 million a year.
Just manage.
Oh, yep, these are new ones
that are above the base.
So then on line 3.3 is a pulmonary research account, which is $100,000 per year ongoing, which is also new funding. Line 3.8 is $400,000 per year ongoing for the noxious weed grants. Those are also new. On line 4.20 is $5 million in fiscal year 24, a one-time appropriation for the grain indemnity fund. Line 4.29 is $75,000 per year ongoing, and this is for the meat processing liaison navigator position at the department. Going to page 5, line 5.7 is the International Trade Expansion Program. This is $150,000 per year ongoing, again, a new appropriation. Line 5.15 is the Minnesota Grown Program Expansion. This is $75,000 per year ongoing as well, a new appropriation. Line 5.31 is the Farm Safety Health and Wellness Grant Program. It's $250,000 per year ongoing and a new appropriation. Line 6.14 is the Farmers Markets Hubs. This is $700,000 in fiscal year 24 and 25, so $350,000 per year. This is also new. Going to page 8, on line 8.21 is the expanded eligibility for farm to school. What this does is expands farm to school to early childhood care center, so it goes just beyond schools to allow them to apply for these funds as well. And then on line 9.22 is the bioincentive program. So it's $2.5 million per year in each fiscal year 24 and 25, and $5 million each 26, 27. On page 10, line 10.1, is the biofuels infrastructure grants. This is $1.5 million per year ongoing. This is new funding. Page 11, line 11.6, is the value-added entrepreneurial support, $250,000 per year ongoing and new funding. Line 11.19 is the agri-meat processing. This is $250,000 per year ongoing and is new funding. Then going to page 12, for the county fair's premium increase, this is $200,000 per year ongoing. Then on page 12, so this is through line 12.12 through page 14, line 14.1, we have pass-through grants. There's $800,000 that's spread out between fiscal year 24 to 25 to multiple different organizations. Then on page 14, line 14.5, is the second harvest milk allocation. This is $250,000 per year ongoing, and this is new funding specifically for milk. On page 16, line 16.8, is the Good Acre Leaf Program, which is $100,000 per year ongoing and new funding. Line 16.15 is services to BIPOC producers and businesses. This is $250,000 per year ongoing. Then page 16, line 16.2 is the Emerging Farmer Office expansion. This is $700,000 between fiscal years 24 and 25 and $625,000 per year ongoing in new funding. And then we have on page 17, line 17.25, the Ag Emergency Account. This is for $1.5 million in fiscal year 24 in new funding. Line 17.29 is IT modernization. This is $2.4 million in fiscal year 24 to 25, so $1.2 million per year. And then on line 18.1 is the Climate Implementation Coordinator. This is $150,000 per year ongoing and is new funding. Line 18.13 is the Ag BMP loan program increase. So this goes to $4 million in fiscal 25 and $3 million per year ongoing in new funding. And then line 18.23 is the beginning Emerging Farmers Equipment Grants, $200,000 per year ongoing in new funding. Line 18.28 is the RFA capacity increase, which is $150,000 per year ongoing in new funding for the department. And then here on the snapshot, so to maintain our service levels, we have just over $8 million in fiscal year 24 and 25, and just over $9 million in fiscal year 26 to 27. Our new general fund asks for fiscal year 24 to 25 is just over $44 million, and our new general fund asks for 26-27 is just over $70 million, which totals to just over $115 million. Okay, so then we're going into some of the budget neutral changes, statutory changes. So the RFA down payment assistance grant extension is one of the first ones here, so keeping that program going. And so we heard a lot that the timeline was too short, and that was because we had a deadline to get this money out, and so we're looking to change that going forward. The Emerging Farmers Work Group, so we did a little bit of cleanup on this language, so we condensed reports into just one report at the end. We included more definitions of what the office will do, and then also establish the beginning farm equipment grant program within that. And then you'll see also the report that we'll do on the grants and the program and their work will be, you can find that online, 32.10. And then we also have expanded option for ag sustainable ag demonstration grants. This allows in-kind work to be included in these grants. Then on lines 33, starting on 33.19 is modify the BKIL compensation fund. And then we have, after that, the pulmonary research account updates as well, which that account now has funding with this bill. And then on line 36.25 is the fertilizer tonnage fee increase. And so this one would increase the fee per ton on fertilizer to help us fund the program at the department to do the inspections and work with that program. And then we have also an updated fee structure for nursery certificates starting on line 37.6. And this is just to kind of clarify some of that language and have clear, a clear fee structure that works better for the program. And then the pet food registration streamlining, what this one does is it allows the manufacturers to not have to send in a label every single year. They can just send in a label when they update the food, so it's streamlining for them and for us, so it creates less administrative burden. The food licensing fee dedication, this allows us to collect the funds for licensing into a dedicated account to fund this program versus going into the general fund. The plan review fee modernization, this one allows the plan review to better serve our clients by focusing more so on the size of the business for the fees, and then just kind of streamlining the process a little bit better as well. The Agri Sunset Extension, this one's a pretty important program to us, so this would allow the program not to sunset, so we want to keep that program going because we do a lot of important work with that, so that's a pretty important one. The OSB Production Incentive Amendments, this one changes the programs. There were some kind of changes made to it recently, so that kind of clarifies some of that information. The Grant Indemnity Program, we have talked at length about this program, so there's a couple of pages in there that explain this program. We can talk more about it, but it would create kind of a safety net for farmers when we have the grain elevator failure. The IT Modernization Fee Authority, this would allow the department to collect fees when people apply for licensure or permits, and that would help us keep up our infrastructure and serve our clients where they want. And so they want to, you know, apply for license and their permits online, not in paper. So this would help us upkeep that infrastructure. And then we have the Emerging Farmer Working Group Sunset Elimination. Again, we think this is a very important program for the department and want to keep it going, so that would help with that. Then we have a little bit more of the nursery program at cleanup. So going through some of that language, working with our advisory group, they've decided some changes should be made to the program. So that is what those are. And then the clarifying federal fund authority for CWD. This just allows the Board of Animal Health to accept federal funds directly from the federal government. Before they had to pass through the Department of Ag, and now they'll just go directly to them. So just cleaning up language to match current statute.
I could mention too that on page 19, I know Dan Scogan is here with AURI. This was in the bill last year that we worked on, was $300,000 in the first year for equipment upgrades for AURI. And I know Dan is here if there's questions on that.
Yep. And this bill also has the broadband appropriation as well.
Great. Thank you so much for your overview. Are there any additional testifiers? Seeing none, we will move to member discussion and questions. Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Purcell. I need some clarification here. So go back to 16.2. I just need some help understanding. Maybe my math is wrong. So it says 700,000 and then 625,000 per year after. So am I to add the 425 and the 575? But then I go down further, 1631, then it says 625. Am I reading that incorrectly?
I'm not sure who is best to answer. One from the Department of Ag?
Hold on a second. We're because sure. You have to look at what the base is and then add. Hold on. Can you repeat your question? Sorry.
Representative Harder.
Thank you. So, okay, on your handout, it says that it's 700,000 for fiscal year 24-25 and then 625,000 per year ongoing. So when I go to 16.2, I'm trying to figure out where that's at. So it says 16.2, we have 425 the first year and then 575. I'm going to guess that that's supposed to be the 700,000 because then I go further down and then it says the base is 625,000 after that. So am I missing something?
Ms. Medina.
Or can you explain that?
Chairperson, Representative. Yes. So there's already money in the base that adds up to that $700,000. So that's not shown on this sheet. So that it'll be, yes. So it'll be 425 the first year and 575 the second year. And then after that, so looking at fiscal year 26 and 27, it'll be $625,000 ongoing.
And you know what? We can ask our House fiscal, Mr. Savory, if you would care to clear this up for us. Thank you.
Chair and members, to be clear, the base for the emerging farmer appropriation is $150,000 a year. I would point out there's a possible mistake on line 16.31. That reads $625,000. That should read $775,000.
Okay.
The intention is to carry that forward at the recommended amount in the governor's materials.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Okay. Representative Harder, does that clarify the... Yes, thank you. Other discussion or questions to this bill? Lead Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Peterson, I think a significant part of the work we're going to be doing this year is the Grain Indemnity Fund, and maybe you have some folks here that can talk to it, but the one thing that I think we missed the other day from the elevator folks was their concern about doing away with the bonding. And it seems to me they're almost two separate issues in terms of the bonding is not intended to be a safe back if an elevator fails. So why not leave the bonding in place to kind of prove an elevator's financial standing and yet then go ahead with the grain indemnity fund?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Peterson?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, we don't have anybody here who's worked specifically on that, but I've had that, discussion, and when we had our group that met through that, they discussed that, and should we, we looked at really all the options, should we have, keep the bonding in place, because could we do a merger of the two, have some bonding and some indemnity, and this is the way that we chose to do it, but we're always open to suggestions on this, as we've said, as it goes through the process. But I think that the majority of the people and different folks that we recommended that this would be an incentive, then the elevators would not have to carry the bonding. And so, and there was some discussion on that too and everything, and we chose to go this way. So I know what you're saying too and everything, but they're the idea was they wouldn't need the bond as if the we are still because we would have the indemnity to protect the growers. We are still requiring bonding in the bill for, I believe, for new licensees and ones that are having trouble.
Lead Anderson. Additional Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Peterson. This budget is going to Ways and Means, and there'll be a vehicle that, as we actually prepare the bill, and we're starting to run out of time, and be hard to get other bills scheduled. But there was the feral hog bill, and I think you had looked at that and provided comment that you could work with that. If we were to do that as an amendment to the budget bill, is that a what's your thoughts on that?
Commissioner Peterson?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanson, one of my favorite subjects, feral hogs and what's the Eurasian wild boars, and very serious issue, being a number two hog producing state. And keep in mind, too, it's, when we think of hogs, a lot of times we think of a big commercial operations, but we have a lot of really robust backyard hogs, too, and this is very important. In fact, my question has kind of been anecdotally, why do we have so many not feral loose hogs right now? And, when in 2020, when hogs were, so low, I kind of speculated that people just got hogs for free in many cases and that probably didn't need hogs. And so we've had, cases, and we've been working on it with the Board of Animal Health, the DNR. And so that my only concern, Representative, is that, if we have the time to do properly what we need to do. We are watching the feral hogs or the Eurasian in North Dakota that are moving this way from Manitoba. we think it's a little bit of time yet. So, you know, my other thought is if we aren't able to do it this year, at least put in language where we're going to, which I think your bill kind of does, where we got to get together and have a report and then have a more strong recommendation for next year, because the board, the department, and the DNR all have a piece of that. So we're open to suggestions on that, just want to get it right too and everything.
Any other questions or discussion to this bill? Seeing none, closing remarks, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't belabor the time as I know it's getting late. So I will just renew my motion. The House File 2679 be referred to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Vang. Renews her motion. This House File 2679 will be moved on to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay. The motion passes, and House File 2679 is on its way to Ways and Means. And Representative Vang, we'll have you just do your last bill up there, and then I'll pass the gavel back over to you. So this will be House File 1585. Then you can have your seat back.
Yes.
Representative Vang, would you like to move House File 1585 to the General Register?
Yes, that is correct. Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved. Members, we've heard this bill a couple of weeks ago on non-native phragmites. This is going to be a possible vehicle bill for the Ag Committee.
Thank you, Representative Vang. Are there any testifiers from the audience? Member discussion to House File 1585. Seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I renew my motion that House File 1585 be sent to the General Register.
And with that renewed motion from Representative Vang, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed say nay. And the motion carries. House File 1585 will be sent to the General Register. Right. Our members, our final bill for tonight is House File 2472, Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, please move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 2472 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
All right. The bill's before us. We will do an amendment first, and then we'll have you introduce your bill again. We have the A1 amendment. I believe that is Representative Jacob.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Vang. So the A1 amendment just basically classifies data collected by the MDA from the farm as private or non-public. So.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Jacob. I would accept the amendment, but I want to so we may want to come back to it later for one particular thing with federal worker protection standards and record keeping. Those records often, they can be made available for doctors or first responders if there's an emergency, that data could become available. So I think that's something that we should add to this. So it's not just law enforcement, because I think then we'd be consistent with federal worker protection standards, and that they still, it's private, it's not just, hey, I'm doing research, but if there's an incident and it's relating to treated seed, that a first responder can find out if there's been an exposure based on that use. So I don't want to do an oral amendment or anything right now, but when this comes back, that we look at that. So otherwise, I accept the A1 amendment.
Further discussion? Representative Jacob?
Good. Yep. Thank you.
All those in favor of the A1 amendments, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The ayes have it, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Next amendment is the A2. Representative Nelson.
Yes, the A2 amendment would just kind of as the plan for treated seed, that it would begin on August 1st for growing the following calendar year. And, you know, quite oftentimes, you know, before harvest starts, we're already getting requests by our seed growers, our retailers, of getting your purchase in. And, you know, sometimes that plan needs to be developed early and just allowing this, and I would hope this could be a friendly amendment.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I would support the amendment.
All right. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The ayes have it. The motion for the A2 amendment is adopted. And the last amendment we have is the A3. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Vang. The A3 amendment would, before the semicolon on page 2, line 11, as far as certification goes and the written and approved process for the individual to use systemic pesticide-treated crop for seeds, this would require the commissioner to respond to written certification no later than 30 days from receipt of certification. I'm trying to get a timeline around that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I understand what you're trying to get to and wanted to make sure. I don't want to have this could potentially limit the flexibility that the commissioner has. And I think with the Nelson Amendment, with A being in August, that might give some time here. I'd like to oppose it right now, but I'd like to work with you on it in the future because I think it may be a bit limiting. So I would ask for a no vote at this moment. But I'm open to considering it.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Chair Vang. And I hope you are open to that. I'm just concerned that that could drag on, and the 30 days doesn't seem unreasonable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
And I would echo that. I thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. I would hope that, you know, we can, you know, continue this conversation. I think, you know, we're looking at record snowfall right now. I mean, we know that right now there's, if this was in place this year, there's probably going to be some crop acres shifted. And, you know, that may change some things. And so, you know, what may have been in the plan last August may be changing over the next 6 weeks drastically. And, you know, I think being able to adapt and change, I think, is something that we need to be able to have. And, you know, I'd hope that we can continue to work on this.
Representative Hansen?
Yep, I'm open to continuing to work on it, but right now I'd ask for a no vote.
Okay. All those in favor of the A3 motion amendment say aye.
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 Those opposed say no.
No.
The noes have it. The A3 amendment is not adopted. Now to the bill. Representative Hansen, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2472 as amended, and I just would say I think the amendments have improved the bill, and I'm open to working with folks on it. We've been discussing systemic pesticides much of this session and in many previous sessions, and we've discussed before about the difference between seed law and pesticide law, and that treated seeds fall into that netherworld. We've heard other bills about that. This would get another way of trying to provide guidance on systemic pesticide-treated seeds, particularly for those included acetamidopilid on line 1.12 and 1.13 and 1.14. If any of us can pronounce those, we would probably be in good shape, but I'll just reference them because it's getting late. And I think what the good part about this, and I recognize there's a ... for the appropriation, but we hopefully would get a fiscal note on this. The Commissioner of Ag would work on this. He would have an account available, and it gives time for the Commissioner to develop a program for the regulation of systemic pesticide-treated seed and some of the criteria on that, and then having an alternative account. So I believe this provides time, and it gives authority within the Department of Ag for relating to use on these particular seed treatments. So I'd ask for your support.
All right. I have about three testifiers scheduled for today's bill. So we'll start with Chris Cohen from Pesticide Action Network.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Chris Cowan. I'm a contract lobbyist with the Pesticide Action Network, working with the Minnesota Environmental Partnership Pollinator Cluster. Lucas Rhodes will be coming up behind me, but just to share a few things from my point of view about the bill and why we're supporting it. Just some facts. Once again, honeybee losses are high, whether it's the folks in their backyard or the big honey producers. I don't represent the honey producers, but those losses have varied in the 40 to 45% range. I think the last full year that there's results, I think the small timer losses were in the 70s, and in Minnesota, the big beekeepers had losses of 57%. But I think the preliminary results for this past few years is that it's gone down a little. But if you look at the chart over time, the losses are way higher. I was a hobby beekeeper for a period of time, and it was too hard. And so many people with the Minnesota Hobby Beekeepers Association that I talked to, and some professional beekeepers, would refer to when beekeeping was easy. And it's a cocktail of reasons, and varroa mites, if you talk to folks, that's one of them. But mixed in with the cocktail is a lack of forage area and the use of pesticides. And after all, the pesticides that we're talking about, the systemics, are highly effective and very potent, and are persistent in soil and water soluble. And we're talking about legal use. I'd also like to mention the DNR, their deer study. There's neonics in the deer everywhere. One of the things about the systemics about neonics is that they really are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. And if you look at that DNR study, you'll see that there's deer spleens that have been collected in deer from one end of the state to the other. I mean, quite literally. And they have neonics in them. And that study is ongoing to try to figure out why. But the source for neonics is neonics. It's a man-made substance. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It's not naturally occurring. This bill is about stopping or trying to slow down the prophylactic use of systemic treated seed. Basically, as best people can tell from many sources, it's been cited that just about all the field corn in the country has neonic treatment on it. And given how neonics are so widespread and really ubiquitous, ubiquitous field corn, I think it's really time to take a look at that and wonder if it's really needed. I think a lot of soybean farmers have changed their practices, especially in northern climates where they're finding they're not really getting a benefit, and I think we'll hear more about that. I'd like to refer you to a document that I don't know if it migrated to this week's meeting, but it was in last week's, a study done in Quebec about the usefulness of treated seeds for corn, and I think it's a good read because to a large degree, I think the argument could be made that treated seeds are so successful because in so many cases they weren't needed in the first place. Then Minnesota Department of Agriculture in 2016 did their own neonic review. They had their own version of a bill like this. This is not that bill. I hope folks who remember that back when would look at this version with fresh eyes, and it's not the same. We think it streamlines things. Those are my comments today, and that's why a lot of folks like myself support this bill. And I do want to say that, I don't know where Stu is, but I'm the third pick. We were hoping to have a farmer, well, we had a couple farmers lined up, one from Fillmore County and one from Carver County, but because of the setup, they weren't able to make it. But I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Chris Cohen. The next testifier I have is Lucas Rhodes from Natural Resources Defense Council. If you can please identify yourself before the record and proceed.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lucas Rhodes, and I'm testifying on behalf of NRDC and our over 8,500 Minnesota members in strong support of House File 2472. This bill is urgently needed to empower MDA to protect Minnesota's families and ecosystems from harmful pesticides in the form of treated seeds. Upwards of 14 million acres of Minnesota farmland is sown with pesticide-coated seeds, and the vast majority of those seed treatments include neonicotinoid insecticides, or neonics, the neurotoxic pesticides that are driving mass losses of bees and other wildlife and posing ever-increasing threats to Minnesotans' health, especially children's developing brains. State testing shows neonics in Minnesota groundwater, surface water, and even rainwater. They appear in 94% of deer across the state, and CDC monitoring from 2016 shows them in the bodies of half of Americans nationwide, with more recent testing finding them in over 95% of pregnant women across the country, indicating worsening exposure. Seed treatments comprise the overwhelming majority of neonic use in Minnesota, yet MDA currently exercises no direct regulatory authority over seeds treated with neonics or other chemicals. As a result, MDA is blind to the true extent of pesticide use in the state and powerless to address its effects, as it would be expected to do for any other type of pesticide use. This massive pesticide loophole makes no sense, which is why MDA itself has called for legislation to authorize a regulatory program for treated seeds in 2016, as well as a verification of need program for neonic pesticide uses. House File 2472 takes these common sense steps. It does not prohibit use of any pesticide, but empowers MDA to address this gaping regulatory loophole. It also ensures that treated seeds are used only where they provide a benefit, which is crucial because neonic treated seeds are frequently used in situations where they provide no benefit to farmers, as Chris just alluded to. This is a win-win for pollinators, for farmers, and all Minnesotans who value clean water and healthy ecosystems. NRDC urges your support for this bill, and I'd be happy to help answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Lucas. My final testifier is Corey Bennett. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Corey Bennett, representing several different organizations. We tried to condense our testimony and coordinate our testimony as much as we possibly could. So I'm wearing several hats this evening on behalf of Minnesota Agriculture. I'm representing the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, Minnesota Corn, AgriGrowth, and the Sugar Beet Growers Association of Minnesota. I want to thank Chair Hansen for a couple of different brief conversations that we've had on this bill. I think certainly he understands what my concerns are. And so with that, Madam Chair, there are some things that I have concerns with that probably can't be addressed all tonight, so I'll continue working with the author and committee members. But I want to point out the one piece that I think I'd like to focus on the most, and the one piece I think will have the most negative effect on corn and soybean farmers in the state of Minnesota. And so if you want to turn to page 2, line 2.27, clause 3, this is the what I would refer to as the verification of needs section that I had visited with Representative Hansen about. If I read this bill correctly, Madam Chair, this bill would require Minnesota farmers to contact the Department of Agriculture for a verification of need and contact a third party for each use. So I'm assuming, Madam Chair, that's every field in the state of Minnesota that is seeking to plant treated seeds. This puts an intensive and massive burden on farmers and will drastically slow when planting begins. And farmers are already trying to balance weather and field conditions to get crops in the ground. I thank the committee for the A1 amendment that has taken care of one of my concerns with regards to the purchase of seeds. But I also want to put into perspective, Madam Chair, when it comes to Minnesota agriculture, when you look in 2022, Minnesota farmers planted 7.5 million acres of soybeans and 8 million acres of corn. If this bill were to be adopted, what farmers would need to do with these seeds that they had already purchased, as we had talked about seeds being purchased beforehand, what would we do if the farmer had to have these seeds purchased ahead of time, especially if they do not receive formal approval as outlined in this bill? There is no mechanism to recoup costs of seeds that are unused under this bill. These time burdens will hurt farmers and miss an opportunity of the growing season while waiting for an administrative hurdle that they are now going to have to achieve and have to meet. This use is something that we believe that farmers are capable of doing themselves, and some of these decisions have to be made late before the planting season, depending on pest control. Delays in getting these permits will delay planting, and it will hurt yields. Other questions I have, Madam Chair, and then I will finish up. Who's the certifier? Who's going to pay for the certifier? Excuse me. Is it going to be MDA? Is it going to be the farmer? What is the penalty if the farmer decides they're not going to use a third-party certifier? So those are questions I still have, Madam Chair, that I'm sure that I can work with the author and try to further figure out. Lastly, Madam Chair, just finishing up, I would say that I believe that it is important to note that pesticides applied treated seeds go through a tremendously rigorous and scrutinized process, both federally and state regulators. Farmers also take the responsibility for seed stewardship seriously. Proper seed stewardship is not only good for the environment, but it's also good for the farmer's bottom line. So with that, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for your time, and I will continue work with Representative Hansen as this bill continues to be deliberated. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Bennett. Are there any further testifiers that would like to testify for and against on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to discussion to the bill. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the testifiers for their input, and I guess I'll go in reverse order. So how would you verify need? And Mr. Cowan had referenced a Quebec study. There are also studies that were done by U.S. land-grant institutions. The institutions were distributed across the Midwest, so it's not just one institution. It was several. And they found, particularly for soybeans, that there was not a yield benefit. So you could, and this is the beauty of the bill, that it says that it appropriates money this year in 2024, but the program must be developed by 2026. Do you do a class of pesticides, particular products, for particular seed treatments? Do you do a verification of need for certain target pests? Do you do a verification need for certain locations? You know, on a label, you have a variety of things. You've got the target pest. You've got conditions on application when it's a spray. You've got a variety of those conditions. So having the Commissioner of Agriculture, I'm not talking about the whole broad brush, but that is something that the Commissioner could do, is say that you're trying to look at these classes or the specific active ingredients and how do they impact things. Because, again, we're over, if I do my math right and it's late, 14 million acres treated with pesticides that did not exist generally before the year 2000. Essentially, a generation later, we have 14 million acres that are treated with this. And the external costs are showing up in wildlife, in pollinators, in water, in air, and in us. This is not a naturally occurring compound. And I've been here long enough, and when I used to work at the Department of Ag with nitrates, whenever we talked about nitrates, well, there's lightning, and there's manure, and there's cover crops, and there's clover that provide nitrification. There's not a naturally occurring neonicotinoid. We did this, and we're now doing it on millions of acres, not just in Minnesota, but across the country. And this loophole, a lot of pesticide law was done in the 70s at the federal level after Silent Spring. And the federal government delegates the authority to the state government. The major revisions to the Pesticide Control Act were in 1987 and 1989. The 1989 Groundwater Protection Act was a significant revision of the pesticide law. And I think Commissioner Peterson, we were much younger then, back then. But even when that was done, these chemicals didn't exist. 14 million acres, we have to do something. And why not have the expertise with the department to look at that verification of need so that we can get some handle on the treatment? The regulation of the pesticide occurs when the pesticide is applied to the seed.
Further discussion. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hansen. I'm just kind of curious what, you know, you brought up the point of, you know, the regulation happens at the point of treatment. So at the seed, you know, in the plant, you know, and so then the verification of the need of this, do you kind of have an idea of what this would look like or, you know, what's the possibility of what the MDA would look like? For having the certification, would each individual farmer need to be certified, or, you know, if you could just kind of give a little bit of an idea of what that looks like.
Representative Hansen.
So thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nelson. I think if you look on the clauses, six clauses on the second page, so that accounting for the total quantity of the systemic treated, seeded, as well as the total acreage and location. So right now when Commissioner Peterson and his capable staff register a pesticide, they get a percentage of gross sales from the previous year that pays for the registration. So they get, and that data is protected, so they have an idea of the volume sold. The Ensure All Treated Seed is subject to regulatory to protect human health. Number two is pretty simple. You know, that you've got to look at the labels, make sure that it's used and that it has some way of dealing with that particular, trying to protect human health and environment and pollination. Require the formal verification of need. So probably in our lifetime, there is going to be more neonicotinoids, different chemistry come. Commissioner Peterson and his successors will have to look at, do they register those pesticides? If you have this program in place, they can look at, is there a need? Let's say a chemical company comes and says, we've got a new seed treatment for soybeans. And it's, you know, Jiffy. It's going to be better than, it's the version, you know, the latest version of seed treatment. But the data shows that it still is only providing a placebo response. It doesn't have a yield response. So that information is there on the products that are in current use. Again, people are studying neonicotinoids all over the world. And today you can get that information, the peer-reviewed science, and the department can use that in making those decisions. They could also, if my memory is correct, they can ask for information from the registrants in terms of how is the impact on things? Because if there's a special, like a special need request, but even during their registration process, the commissioner has the authority to ask for more information. What is the impact in the field? The University of Minnesota, you get 2.16, and I know the university does not want to be involved in regulation, but they can do research. And earlier this, you know, it seems like just yesterday, but it's probably 2 months ago, we put money in for, we had a bill about doing more research for pollinator activities. Educational materials, number five, pretty simple. Study the use, efficacy, environmental, and health impacts of systemic pesticide-treated seed. So not only when you're making the decisions, but what is happening afterwards. What if the verification of need. And I'm fully aware of weather and those type of things, but I think the commissioner also has authority if you use some examples of weather-related pesticide uses to waive. I mean, we give the commissioner a great deal of authority to be doing some of these things. So I could see classes, I could see geography, that maybe where there's, let's say that one of these compounds maybe has a great deal of water solubility, and that you have an area where you have shallow groundwater. Maybe using the groundwater protection zones, the commissioner says that the risk outweighs the need in those particular areas because this particular compound is solid. So, you know, I understand what Mr. Bennett was saying, but I think we are smart enough to figure this out and that we can use the science to make those questions, answer those questions.
Representative Nelson.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I'm wondering, maybe we could hear from MDA, maybe what, if there's somebody here that might be able to kind of give an idea of what maybe this would look like. You know, does each individual farmer need to be certified, or what does that look like?
I see someone from the department approaching the table. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director for Environmental Programs for Pesticides and Fertilizers at the Department of Ag. So we did prepare a fiscal note which outlines the concepts that we think would go into implementing this. And there's quite a bit of work involved. I think the key question seems to be verification of need. And the way that we envision it is that there would be a trained individual. So we would develop the criteria in coordination with the University of Minnesota. And then we could work through anyone. So any party who proposed to have a training course that met those criteria could actually do the training, similar to what occurred for dicamba recently. And then we would have some kind of a certification process, which the person who went through the training would get approval, and we'd maintain lists for that. And then we would have guidance that would go into that training that would be developed in coordination with the University of Minnesota on BMPs, and the criteria when you may or may not want to use treated seed. And then that trained individual would need to sign a form prior to the use of treated seed in that form. And again, the fiscal note outlines the criteria. But the form would say that they have considered the criteria and that there is a need, a demonstrable need for use of treated seed in that particular field. And they would define the area that would be covered by that certification or approval process. And they would maintain that record. And that record would need to be filled out prior to planting the seed. But it could be just before planting the seed. And then MDA would likely do either we would follow up on complaints or we do some kind of audits to check and make sure those records exist.
Representative Nelson.
So would it, thank you for that, and Madam Chair. And so would that be somewhat similar to what maybe the private pesticide applicator, like somewhat similar to that model then, or?
Mr. Stutter?
Yeah, Madam Chair. Representative, we're not sure exactly how it would go, and so we would need to develop rules and guidance on the criteria. But, you know, we're talking about many farmers across the state, tens of thousands of farmers who would need to do this across millions of acres. So we would want to come up with some criteria, some course that would be like a mini IPM course, something that would provide a lot of value, but it would be something that is executable in the real world.
Representative Nelson.
So, I mean, really, I think if I'm understanding this, I mean, most every farmer would probably have to have this course then.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think an awful lot of farmers would likely take this course, and crop advisors and other people who work with the ag community.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So, prior to treated seeds, I still have insecticide boxes on my planter. Took the drives off of them because once I had the treated seeds, I felt like I was using the very minimal amount of product necessary to get the job done. So if treated seeds become an issue, why wouldn't farmers just go back to putting the insecticide and pesticide in the box and plant?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Jacob, well, I think we've heard earlier about a growing organic market. There are people who may not want to use a chemical. There may be a more market for that. I understand what you're saying, that most of those products had an acute response. They were riskier for the applicator. If you deal with like carbofuran and some of those particular active ingredients, the risk was greater mm-hmm. to the applicator.
Yes.
What the risk is greater here is the persistence of these products that affects the overall environment. So the persistence is the problem. Now, we still have old chemistry that's being used, atrazine probably the most common, that is persistent. And the department for as long as back when I was there, which is now a long time ago, had restrictions on where you could use or guidance BMPs for atrazine. And the label had restrictions. And it became a restricted use pesticide because it was persistent and it leached. And so I want to go back to what I mentioned earlier, which I think limits a little bit in terms of the broad applicability. When you look in the front end and the products that are being registered, the verification of need could occur there on a class, on an active ingredient, and on basis around the state. If you've got a product that doesn't have an impact on yield, that is a decision that could be done within the existing registration on the verification. But the only authority the department has, is on the registration of the pesticide to the seed, not on the treated seed. It's not on the treated seed. They don't have that authority on the treated seed. They have the authority on the regulatory side up to that application and the registration of that project. So back on the question of who is the third party validator? It could be the certified crop advisor. It could be the dealer, the commercial applicator that is going out. It could be somebody who is, there used to be extension staff, but they are not going to be likely to be involved in the regulatory. The private sector has had the certified crop advisor programs for many years. So I think you can find the third party validators on this. And there's the ability, if there is weather or those type of things, to have the flexibility to move on that. So not my intent to say this is everybody all the time. I think when we look at pesticides, often the discussion is, well, how come you're not banning everything or you're trying to ban everything? But what does the department regulate? Use, disposal, rate, timing, method of application, wind, distance from water. Those are all things that are conditions on the pesticide, but not on the treated seed because it doesn't fall into that. So there could be a verification broader, and there could be restrictions broader. And if you're in a very environmentally sensitive area, maybe that's the place where there is a need and that verification can occur. But if you're putting a product out there that has no impact except it had a good marketing campaign and it doesn't affect your yield, why let that on the market? Why let that, if it has an externalized cost that all of us have to bear, literally, why would we do that?
Representative Jacob.
I heard a long answer, but I didn't hear the answer to, if I can't get treated seed, why wouldn't I just go back to using the insecticide box that's already there on my planter that I used successfully for 30-some years? I didn't hear an answer to that.
Representative Hansen.
I'm sure some of those products are no longer on the market.
Representative Jacob.
This would probably drive them back on the market. And also, what about buying seed outside of state? So how would that?
Mr. Stutter.
Madam Chair, Representative, so there'd be two parts to this, to what we understand how we would approach implementing this rule. And again, it's outlined in the fiscal note. So one would be through our existing seed program. And so they would track sales and they would track use. And we envision that use wouldn't be by acre, but it would be by region. So there would be some required reporting so we have some idea on where the products are actually being used, the treated seed is being used. And then the second part would be on use. And again, that would go into the certification course. There'd be have to be some kind of a course that a person who is signing off on the verification of need would need to take. And again, we envision that would be an integrated pest management kind of course. Be developed in coordination with the University of Minnesota, make sure that we're talking about the economics and where the products actually are needed. And then an individual would have to sign off on the use of that seed in that area prior to planting.
Representative Jacob.
So I guess the specific question was, can a farmer buy his seed in a different state, bring it back and plant it in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you.
Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair Vang. Chair, the story. I used to have a dozen fruit trees in my yard, and every year it started to decline. And I didn't know. And then one year, I had no fruits in my yard. And I said, oh, maybe the bees missed my yard. I waited a second year, third year, I had no fruits. So thank you, Representative Hansen, for taking attention to detail about this about this issue on the pesticide and for your detailed work on that. I think as member of this committee, as the Ag Committee, it is our responsibility to take action. And I think we are 23 years too late, and so let's take some action. So I would support this bill. But I want to urge you, with your leadership, to continue to work with the stakeholders. I think the healthy discussion that we had across the aisle and in this committee definitely is helpful to this issue, and I appreciate the conversation we've had in this committee on this particular bill, and so thank you for that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Oh, where do you start? Anyway, Representative Hansen, you know, I don't think anybody, a farmer or anybody in business, would apply a product if it didn't have an economic return. And you were talking about why put it on there if there's no return. Well, we put it on there because there is a return, especially on corn. You know, soybeans, yeah, I would agree that, you know, that is treated at the time of planting, actually, but corn is different. And study after study shows an economic impact to the value of treated seed with corn. A couple of things when the Department of Ag gentleman is up there. An earlier testimony, and I have this here, I wrote it down, he said that MDA is blind to the use of neonics. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Sutter?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do not have authority for treated seed. So we do monitoring of waters, and we certainly are concerned about potential impacts of neonics, but we really don't have any way to understand the sales or how they are used in Minnesota.
Representative Anderson.
So you're saying you have no idea to even take a guesstimate as to how many acres are planted to treated seeds in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative, we could make an estimate. I mean, we would have access to the same information you do, but there really is no reporting of use.
Representative Anderson.
Okay, another question. We've talked about that neonics have been found in the spleens of deer all over the state. There's not a lot of corn planted up in the Iron Range, northern Minnesota. How do you account for deer way out of the traditional corn-growing areas having neonics in their systems?
Madam Chair, Representative, we're not sure.
Representative Anderson.
Gee, okay. You know, I understand the intent of this. Oh, one more thing I've got to say. This goes back to 2017 when we talked about this whole issue again, and again, kind of a compromise was the pollinator account, where we set aside, I think, millions of dollars to go to the university, and the prime focus was to improve habitat for pollinators. And I would really like to get an accounting from them or whomever is doing that as to how many more acres we have today than we did 6 years ago after spending millions of dollars to improve bee habitat. Can anybody supply us with any information about improved habitat for deer in the last few years?
Representative Hansen. Or
pollinator.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. So the pollinator count was for research, not for changing the practices. And let me be real clear. That pollinator count was set up only for habitat and not to look at any impacts of pesticides. It was to look at habitat only because explicitly it prohibited, it did not include pesticides. And if we look at the research that's been done, what we did in 2013 and 2014 is required, we have created a bee lab. We've created the Caravo Native Bee Lab. We have funded bee research, so it's not just honeybees. It's native bees trying to get a basis of things. We have looked at research, and the university has done research on varroa mites and Nosema and all types of other products. We have a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient in Marla, and she has said it as Mr. Cohen said, it is parasites, poor nutrition, poor habitat, and pesticides. On the first three, we have spent a lot of money on research on parasites. We have said on public lands, whether it's outdoor heritage or DNR lands, that when we buy lands and we restore lands, we use the public dollar on the public lands for pollinator habitat. We've had cities and counties and school districts all over our state voluntarily adopt policies to put in pollinator habitat and be bee friendly. But they don't have the ability to restrict pesticides. Representative Tabke, they don't have that ability. Don't have that. We have spent 10 years on this pollinator journey. And we have done about everything possible on habitat, nutrition, and parasites. But whenever we try to do anything on pesticides, it's opposed.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, we don't hear about how many additional acres. You know, we've talked, we went for a couple of years saying we can't more road ditches to provide more pollinator habitat. And then comments made that, well, the DNR has literally thousands of acres that could be put to better use for pollinators. And I'm just wondering if we've made progress on those in those areas as well, providing additional habitat for bees. And again, looking at some of the research that I've seen, I think the census or the study was done to January of 2021 was the last year I saw that showed bee colonies actually increased by 2%. The last census that I saw for deer. And I mentioned before that I have a pasture and I have a beekeeper that has bees in my pasture, and he sends his bees out to California every winter to pollinate almond trees. And I talked to his mother a couple of weeks ago, and she said he had his worst season ever out there this winter because it rained all the time, a lot of rain out in California, and he lost 70% of his hives out there because of that. So I think we're seeing a lot of things entering into this, and you know, my concern is that we're messing with Minnesota's agriculture in a way that I think makes farmers uncomfortable by having big government standing over them and telling them when to use seed, when not to use treated seed. And I think it just makes farmers uncomfortable. And again, agriculture is one of the top two businesses in our state. And I think we need to be careful when we go making some fundamental changes that could really impact the yields, especially of corn here in Minnesota. So those are my comments, Madam Chair.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question might be directed towards someone from the pollinator folks, if they're still here.
Do you mean testify Chris Cohen from Pesticide Action Network?
Okay. I think that's who it was.
Right.
Or maybe Representative Hanson probably can answer this.
I believe he is still here.
So I'm curious, because my recollection is that in 2017 there was a petition to EPA to regulate treated seeds, and it's kind of it languished for a while. And whatever happened with that petition?
Mr. Cohen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the petition was denied. But having said that, I think it's fair to say, well, I would say that there is a National Association of Pesticide Regulators who I don't know if their letter and paper was directly to what you have brought up or otherwise, but they basically make the same arguments that we're making, and I'm talking about the Association of Pesticide Regulators and their subgroup working on treated seeds. They make the same arguments. I can provide the letters to the committee. Their remedy is for the EPA to act. Now, why don't we wait? When it came to PFAS, Minnesota didn't wait, and I think we're better for it. And I don't think we should wait. And I realize that we're a big ag state, and I appreciate all the concerns about this, but I hope folks take a careful look at it. And I did drop off some materials to some of you. I did have a chance to talk to Chair Anderson, and I always respect his opinion, and I always appreciate the conversation. But it is true, to answer your question, that I believe was the result, that the EPA denied it. But I would say that in light of the fact that the state regulators, as a national organization, to my eyes, are saying, you know, something has to be done, that this loophole has to be closed, I think we're at a crossroads. And I think, and I would urge members to consider making a change that would work for Minnesota. That's what we did on PFAS, and we're still working on that. And I think I think we should explore this. I don't like any regulations, but you know, there's a lot. I abide by them, and I believe in them. You know, for the most part. I mean, so there's speed limits, there's stop signs, on and on. The zoning laws apply to my house. I think we have to look at the situation in its entirety. And right now, we got a lot of neonics floating around, and they're starting to show to have an impact. And if you look at the South Dakota State study that the DNR used as the basis for their work, that study indicates that there is harm being done to the deer. So the DNR is now trying to explore seeing if that's taking place in Minnesota with their further studies, and that's why they're requesting money for the LCCMR project that they had denied. But
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the short answer is yes, the EPA denied. The only concern I've got, and I'll go back to Representative Jacob's comment as he closed out, and then I'll close out. But, you know, making Minnesota an island to itself, I don't disagree with what you're saying, and I understand your point. But making Minnesota an island to itself is really dangerous. And I live on a border, in a border community close to North Dakota. I mean, folks can run across the border anytime and buy. I just think that you have to have a wider perspective on how we regulate this product. As Representative Jacobs said, someone can run across the border and buy seed. And the fact that EPA didn't feel the need to regulate this just kind of said something to me. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So as I'm listening to the testifiers and about this, this really sounds like quite a bit of government overreach. And I almost feel like I have to reach out to the commissioner to get permission to whether or not I can plant seed that works well for our property. And I just want to caution that government overreach. You do not want to have angry farmers showing up at your doorstep. I'm just curious, because a lot of us farmers, we know how to do things well, and if we are left alone to farm, we do take care of our properties, because it matters. If we don't take care of our properties, we're not going to make any money. So my question I have is, this seems fairly massive, I mean, in my mind. I mean, how many people are going to be needed to run this program? I mean, there are a lot of farmers. I mean, if we each have to be certified, I just can't imagine how it's even going to be managed. Do we have any idea what that would be?
Representative Hansen?
Well, you have to and have had to be licensed for as a certified private pesticide applicator since the 1970s. When I ran that program, there were 33,000 people that had that. I'm guessing now it's probably might be 10,000, roughly. There's certified private applicators. And there's been more things that have been classified as restricted use pesticides.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Vang. I just want to remind people that when they make these laws regulating farmers, we know how best to manage our farms. Each one of us have farms and our land is different. And we probably use different seed, different pesticides because it pertains for our property. And it just seems like some of these bills that maybe the state doesn't want as many farmers. I mean, when the cost keeps going up, the fees that are added, it just makes us wonder why. Why continue? Because we're not going to make as much money. And when we don't make money, then we don't help our areas grow because we don't have the funds to help other businesses that are around. Don't get me wrong. I care about you bees. I care about bees a lot. I care about everything. But we need to work together to make sure that farmers can farm and not try to regulate them out of business. Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm going to give the perspective of a mom of three. When my kids were little, I would go out of my way to buy organic foods because I wanted them to have foods that my grandparents and my great-grandparents and my great-great-grandparents ate, you know, foods that weren't contaminated with pesticides. And now that I'm looking at the neonics and, you know, how this started, in 2000, you know, this, if you want to make money, you're going to have to cater to people who actually want to buy your food. And I'm thinking a lot of people aren't going to want to buy food that's contaminated. So I think it actually is really good for business. You know, there are certain things that I you know, buy online. I look to see, you know, does it have any kind of label, like a couch. A couch might have a label that says, hey, in California, this couch cannot be sold there. This comes with a warning. I'm going to buy products that are safe for my family because I don't want to bring things into my home that could possibly adversely affect the health of my family and of my community. So, I mean, I think this is good practice for our businesses to be very conscious of what we're putting on our food, what we're putting on our fields, what's going into our soil and our water. I know I'm not the only one who is willing to pay more money for products that don't have pesticides, that don't have additional chemicals added to them. So I think that's a perspective we need to keep in mind, too. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the comment on safe foods. And I just saw a report on TV the other night. It showed the foods that were most they contaminated by pesticides and those that were the least contaminated. And the most contaminated thing that we eat is strawberries, which you know, is not a typical production agriculture crop. And one of the least contaminated crops was sweet corn that is raised by a lot of people here in Minnesota. And just a clarification, if I can find it again. Well, I think I lost it. But, Madam Chair, if I could ask for a second, again, this is pushing up on 8 o'clock, but if we could get a quick comment from the retailers in Minnesota. I think Patrick Murray is up there. If he could comment on, and what this would do to the retail supply chain with seed. I think that would be very important for the committee to hear that, Madam Chair.
All right. If you can please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some remarks tonight. My name is Patrick Murray. I'm with the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. We represent the ag retailers throughout the state, the distributors, the crop input suppliers, crop advisors, certified crop advisors, and the registrants who supply farmers throughout the state with the products that I think we are talking about here tonight. And I just wanted to provide a little context because I was actually out at one of our member facilities earlier today to provide a legislative update and talk about some of the legislation that we're facing. And there were some long faces in the crowd when they did hear about this. And one of the reasons is because you look at the neonicotinoid-treated seeds, and this is a practice that has been in place for some time. The product has been approved by the federal government, and it's very helpful for these folks to grow their crops. Now, we could talk about pesticides that are used outside of the seed, but one of the big things is that when it already is compacted into the seed, that means that there's less passes that a farmer has to do, as we talked about earlier, Representative, as it relates to an application. So the seed is already contained with the pesticide, less passes. It's good for the environment as it relates to carbon emissions, tractor passes, compaction of dirt. And I just wanted to, again, provide that context that the co-ops, the retailers that I represent, they're also very short-staffed. You know, if you put something like this into law, the overarching principle of this bill, and we're already short-staffed. I mean, I talked to some of the retailers, and they're down 30, 40 people, drivers, agronomists, other folks that work there at their retail facilities. So I look at it as an economic disadvantage as well. We don't want to make Minnesota another island as it relates to our surrounding states. I think I could speak that all the states surrounding Minnesota do not have anything as progressive as this creation of this program. So just wanted to provide that context and give you all folks a little bit taste of what I learned out in the countryside today. So thanks for asking me to come up, Representative Anderson, and I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Members, we are at 8 o'clock hour, and we can choose to go longer, although I would not recommend to do so. Representative Anderson.
Just to clarify, and this is from statute 18B.051. Money is appropriated to the university or pollinator research and outreach, including but not limited to science-based best practices in the identification and establishment of habitat beneficial to pollinators. So it is more than just pollinator research in terms of habitat, but also other research for pollinators in current statute, Madam Chair.
Further discussion. Closing remarks, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, we've heard a lot about profit and economic disadvantage, but the issue here is the environmental disadvantage we all bear. We all bear in our water, in our air, in our wildlife, in our pollinators, and again, in us. And if we lift that environmental disadvantage and we have an environmental advantage and we have changes and opportunities and growing for a market, you may actually flourish as an island. Some islands are an oasis and people move to oasis if the desert isn't hospitable. 10 years. These folks that come and testify, and the argument has not changed in 10 years, and it will not change 10 years from now. Never, ever change anything related to pesticides. Fight everything. The reason there is no neonicotinoid deer study, to get back to it, is the Senate killed it, pulled it out of the LCCMR last year. I wonder how that happened. I wonder. This is something we can do, along with the other bills we've heard. to make progress. I renew my motion to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hansen renews his motion. House File 2472 is laid over for possible inclusion as amended. Our next meeting is Tuesday, March 21st, 2023, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.